voice of childhood whisper violence. Cold wind beating out of the past. Rage in your throat, muffled silence. Hold on, I will stand fast. In the darkness, your guardians had left you. Cold wind beating out of the past. None to hear your cries, none to defend you. Hold on, I will stand fast. I will stand fast. I will stand fast. You are saved in the daylight at last. Nightmare and fear, they have no power here. I will stand fast. I will listen to the terrors that tried you. Cold wind beating out of the past. Child that breathes inside you. Hold on, I will stand fast. Though you take the shape of 100 ancient horrors. Cold wind beating out of the past. Though you strike at me and flee into your sorrow. Hold on, I will stand fast. I will stand fast. I will stand fast. You are safe in the daylight at last. Nightmare and fear, they have no power here. I will stand. On a branch in winter. Cold wind beating out of the past. Ice in the sun begins to splinter.
Hold on, I will stand fast. You will walk with no fetters to bind you. Cold wind beating out of the past. All the love you have wanted will find you. I will stand fast. I will stand fast. I will stand fast. You are safe in the daylight. Nightmare and fear, they have no power here. I will stand fast. I will stand fast. And that was Fred Small, I Will Stand Fast. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, and www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse, and this is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Sunday morning civil rights, if you can grab them, in Santa Cruz. In the studio with me, just setting up here as we start a little late, my apologies to everybody for that, is Pat True. who I promised you I would try to grab for the show. I talked about his hunger strike last show on Thursday, and of course it's chronicled at www.santacruz.indymedia.org, Santa Cruz Indy Media, which under the story Tent U Police Brutality Update, Pat True on Hunger Strike, it kind of gives you some of the background. But since we got the real man in the studio, let's see, first of all, we got a mic working. Say something.
Good morning, everyone.
It works. Wow, cool. Well, you are a UC Santa Cruz worker and a member of the local Q union. Is this the clerical union? Is this a plot by the union just to draw more attention to its overpaid workers? What's the deal here?
No, there is no connection at all between Q and the Tent University activity. That is a completely independent group of people, very concerned young people, students here at UCSC, about their concerns about breaking of civil liberties in the United States in general, and also about their concerns about poor choices of spending in the UC budget program.
I know I was speaking facetiously, of course, and I do that a lot, so people who know me regularly kind of bear with me. My humor gets a little dry at times. But, you have been on hunger strike or fast or both since April 18th?
Yes, this is day 13.
And though you said so many times before, and you very articulately put it on the Internet, why don't you tell us why you're doing this?
Well, it began, of course, with the first day of Tent University. As the evening drew near, the folks at the Tent University, the young people, had worked with the UCSC administration. They wanted to hold this event, and they wanted to express their concerns, and they wanted to have a dialogue about these concerns, and they wanted it to not only be a campus, but also the community of Santa Cruz to be involved. And they felt like that at least 5 days should be committed to this to get the ball rolling. And they had planned a day and evening fellowship gatherings. And I had been at a couple of the planning meetings before this, and one of the things that really impressed me about the whole group of students was their commitment to having a very peaceful and a very positive event. And so as we came to the evening of Monday, April 18th...
Before we go into that, which of course is key, what was this event supposed to be focused on? Because I know I heard a lot of concerns that, oh, the camping issue has hijacked everything, is something we're going to talk about in a minute. And indeed, we just call Tent University. People were setting up tents for a particular purpose, the fellowship, I think you mentioned. But what were there some specific issues? I'm asking you, I know, but what's your sense of the issues the students were concerned about up there, and the community, in fact, Tent University organizers?
That's kind of interesting. It was actually they didn't have these concerns laid out clearly before Tent University started in some respects, because part of the Tent University process was to define these. And I believe a few days ago they made their final group of recommendations public. And I apologize, I don't have those here with me.
I can't find them on the Internet. I probably just haven't been able to locate them yet. If anybody knows where they are on Indy Media, please give a call. And by the way, if you want to call in and ask questions of Pat here, it's 427-3772, 831-427-3772. Or you can jump on the chat room if you find the phone line busy or it's more convenient for you, pagesincolor.com, all one word, pagesincolor.com. Small letters, pagesincolor.com. And the number again, 427-3772. Go ahead, what you were saying.
Off the top of my head, I know that they're concerned about the spending priorities in the UC system at large and UCSC. The fact that money is being spent to build buildings and on high administrative salaries and bonuses, and neglecting the salaries. Here in Santa Cruz, this campus specifically, we have a serious problem where the cost of living has skyrocketed due to the success in Silicon Valley and folks working in Silicon Valley who moved over here into our beautiful community and caused the prices to go up. And the workers here at Santa Cruz, who are custodians, food service, and a lot of the groundskeeper folks and the clericals, cannot make ends meet on the salaries that they're paying. The UC Office of the President is fully aware of this and is totally ignoring this issue.
It's not just, of course, Silicon Valley people. It's the fact that the university is cramming more and more students onto the campus.
Correct.
And not providing the affordable housing or even the unaffordable housing that it's supposed to for the students, right?
Right. And they're not supporting the community of Santa Cruz, the city and the county. They're doing what they want, and they don't care about the impact. I shouldn't say they don't care, but they're not very caring about the impact in traffic, the impact to the water system, the impact to waste disposal, and such things. Also, the university seems to have plenty of money to be building buildings all the time. So this is part of it. Another area that they're concerned with is the DOD research dollars that are being spent up at the University of California. We would like to see...
Department of Defense.
We would like to see these projects discontinued.
Those are those defenders who invaded Iraq 2 years ago, right?
Correct.
Yes.
Those guys.
Yes.
The fascists. I shouldn't say it.
Oh, for heaven's sake. The F word. Uh-oh. You don't want to exaggerate. Don't call it Abu Ghraib.
Right.
For heaven's sakes.
You know, right.
It's different now.
Yes.
Okay.
And which brings me back to the whole bottom line here.
Mm-hmm.
The fascism in the United States is on a roll. It's picking up and it's getting worse and worse. And in my lifetime, I thought that we were reducing fascism in the world. And here we've entered an era where it's just rampant. And when it came to Santa Cruz County and when it came to the campus base of UCSC on Monday night, April 18th, I said, that's friggin' it. I'm putting my foot down.
By fascism, of course, you're referring to police behavior in arresting the 19 students and assaulting other people as they were doing this?
Right. The use of cruel and degrading treatment, which is a direct violation of the United States Declaration of Human Rights.
How can a little strangulation be called cruel and degrading? I mean, after all, it's kind of a useful training exercise for the police, don't you think?
Well, if this was something that we did every day at lunch to each other, it probably wouldn't qualify.
Well, how are you going to get those damn students to move? They link their arms. You know, what's the beef, man?
The beef is we've got to have a community which respects each other. And if the UCSC administration doesn't understand what respect is, we have a serious problem in this community. And I guess we should include the city of Santa Cruz, going off on a tangent slightly, with their dealing of homeless people. Santa Cruz needs to step up. Santa Cruz has always been one of the best communities in the United States dealing with civil rights and respect of people.
I'm sorry.
We're not perfect, mm-hmm. but we need to be moving towards being perfect.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Wow. Santa Cruz is one of the only communities, one of the few communities in the United States that actually criminalizes sleep at night for the overwhelming majority of its homeless population. There are many other communities that don't. And though Mayor Mike Rotkin will tell you, well, that's because we don't beat them up and drive them out of town. Instead, we just have a sleeping ban. And we sort of give them exercises in staying awake at night and that sort of thing. And it's only for, you know, a problematic minority. Fact of the matter is that Santa Cruz has a law that violates basic human rights conventions. In fact, I think you've been aware of... is it Liz Fagan-Ginger? Is that her first name?
Oh, Anne.
Anne Fagan-Ginger,
who spoke here just a Friday ago.
And on free radio as well. And she has
Excellent.
A book published. You can go to her on the Internet. She talked about using not the U.N. Charter, per se, but I guess international covenants that the U.S. has signed.
Treaties, correct.
That requires the U.S. to at least report on these allegations of human rights violations here in Santa Cruz. And I guess that could happen up at UCSC.
Two things that they are to be reporting. One is the current status on a yearly basis of human rights abuses and on progress, which has been made that year to reduce human rights violations.
Or regression, perhaps.
Or regression, unfortunately. Yeah.
So you were actually up on campus April 18th and saw the events, or you saw them?
I was.
Yeah, were you part of the resisting group? By resisting, I mean the group that were supporting their right to assemble and sat down. It was interesting, the police declared an unlawful assembly, but then only went after dispersing and arresting the people that sat down with their arms linked, sitting in a tent where they obviously weren't camping, they were meeting. So it wasn't a camp in that sense. There was no cooking equipment. There were no sleeping bags. There were some backpacks, I suppose. Maybe there was a sleeping bag or two. But no, I didn't see sleeping bags rolled out. And, of course, the camping ban, at least the sleeping and blanket ban sections of it, goes into effect both in the campus law and the city law at 11 o'clock at night, campus regulation in the city law. So there wasn't any actual... I guess there was a violation of the so-called free speech ends at 8 rule. You want to talk about that at all?
Right. That's a total pile of crap. The university is supposed to be a place, you would think it would be the ultimate place for free speech. And to have the university set aside 3 or 4 small locations where you're allowed to have free speech from 9 until 5 p.m., or some such along those lines, is ludicrous. The campus is set up for people to express their opinions and to foster that whole attitude of exchange of ideas, exchange of possible solutions and such. And to think that that's only viable during the middle of the day is asinine.
Well, there's the safety of the students to consider. They might, you know, be led astray by late-night conversations. There could be sexual assaults, wild parties, who knows, revolutionary behavior, late at night, bonfires. I mean, of course, I'm speaking facetiously, and I know that the whole point of Tent University was not just to establish a sort of the daytime, we all come and go to class and then go home, but to establish a sort of a round-the-clock fellowship, right, which is what
you're
saying.
And
that actually didn't happen at this Tent University, as I understand it, because even though, and I said this on the air before, there was a wonderful victory where the students, in spite of this torture,
they left.
They all
and
went,
the students had every intention and had stated to the campus administration that they would try and address their concerns. They put out the word very clearly that nobody attending Camp University would have open flames. There would be no use of drugs, no use of alcohol. So they tried to meet the campus's concerns about liability. And they did. They went out of their way to address the concerns of liability to the university.
But you've got to give the university credit. They went out of their way to block the use of sanitary facilities like porta-potties that the students wanted.
Oh, that was very clever on their part. I applaud that.
Yeah, they're on top of it. You know, I mean, and then they made sure that bathrooms were not open at the base of campus, like at the barn and so forth.
Correct.
In order to, of course, then claim that there was a sanitation problem, which is a way of addressing the issue politically. That chancellor's not no dummy.
No, and they're taking lessons directly from our White House on how to circumvent civil rights and how to set things up in such a way as to make
Wait
it look
a minute.
Like...
Are you suggesting they're setting up protest zones, like at the quarry, where it's okay to be at night but not at other places on campus, like the base of campus?
And definitions of violations, such that you just start breathing and you're a violator.
Well, again, it seemed the violation, as I said before, was selective. Even though they declared this was an illegal assembly, I guess around 9:30 in the evening on April 18th,
yes,
they didn't go after the assembly. They went after the people who were not standing and milling and angry. They had people who were sitting down with their arms length talking to each other.
It was very interesting. The students, of course, this was a open democracy, a direct democracy, and as they went along, they did votes of the whole group and got a consensus. And they, towards the deadline of the possible police action, they took a vote and said, who wants to be a civil disobedience, participate in the civil disobedience, and who wants to be an observer? And they broke up into two groups. The ones for civil disobedience sat in the tent and locked arms, and the observers gathered around the tent
and not
to
only
watch.
That, but for 4.5 hours or beforehand, throughout the afternoon, they raised the issue. They didn't decide themselves, we're going to violate this university dictate that we not camp, that we not stay overnight, that we abandon the right to assemble after 8 o'clock at night. But they put it up to the whole community that was gathered there. They put out, and everybody talked about it.
Correct.
And the people in the little 15 circles sent representatives to each into a larger circle.
Correct.
And the large circle consensed on it. And there was a decision. They had numerous options not to camp, to camp sort of in scattered places, to go to the quarry, as the university at that point suggested, I guess, again, after making the suggestion.
Correct.
And pulling it back, and then came back with it again and said, but you can't do it with any community members.
Correct.
That was, and that's what they said. And then they made this final decision that they were gonna camp, and they were gonna essentially continue their assembly. I mean, to me, it wasn't the issue. They weren't saying everyone has a right to camp on campus anytime they want. They said, in this particular time, in this particular place, it is reasonable and legitimate to do what we're doing. We've made all possible, we made all reasonable accommodations to the university.
Correct. And it was just for 5 days, and the issue was that the students was a primary issue to the students was that there was no way of having a really good fellowship with a community if it wasn't at the base of campus, because the community is so the campus is so isolated. For people to come by and just drop in without having to drive all over campus and try and figure out where the heck this is
and
where the heck
park.
That is. Where to park. There's no parking up there. Here's a place that was easily accessible and allowed for a nice fellowship arrangement.
And visible as
and
well.
And visible.
So it seems to me the university was trying to repress a public assembly, perhaps because the assembly was concerned with, though it didn't have the issues specifically outlined, as you mentioned, they were going to develop the issues through this direct democracy process. University felt perhaps concerned about things like the driving of recruiters off campus some weeks before, the strike, the march against salary cuts and program cuts, the march against the governor's programs, though I'm not sure what maybe university officials, I'm sure they felt on that. I have, by the way, we're talking, just let me interrupt this by saying we're talking with Pat True, who's on hunger strike, has been since April 19th, because of, it wasn't so much the university decision to say, no, you can't go there. It had to do with how the university tried to implement its decision.
The response. Right? They tried to repress the students from this activity. And when repression didn't work, they went to oppression. They went in there, and their intent was to make a lesson of these students by doing something cruel and degrading. Sending a signal to the other students that you'd better get in line. And students, the UCSC student community up there, if you're listening, I know a lot of people have expressed to me that they are now afraid of speaking their mind. And so it is so important that we don't let this go by. That basically, I think the bottom line is that the university needs to admit wrongdoing with the brutality that was committed on the 18th. They need to pay retribution to the people that were impacted. Restitution, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. to the people that were arrested. And they also, I would say, they need to ask for reassigning Chancellor Denton to a position where she can't hurt anybody.
Not to mention Flax, Liz Irwin, and others, right?
Oh, yes. There's a group of them up there.
I mean, I think that people who lied about the situation and misrepresented, and we can talk about the specific allegations of
that
falsehood.
That is intolerable.
I mean, how can the university have credibility? I guess they don't even care. It's like Bush. He doesn't care if they're weapons of mass destruction or not.
Right. Truth isn't
important anymore. As long as
he can
move on to the
next
issue and use force.
Is truth not important anymore? Maybe it isn't. Maybe I'm old-fashioned.
Well, you know, I think you're trying to defend your name. Pat True.
R-R-R.
You want to talk to Pat True and to me here,
yes,
on
please
air?
Yes, please call in.
Please. 427-3772, 427-FRSC. And it's an open line. You can also go to pagesincolor.com, pagesincolor, one word, .com. We talk about degrading and humiliating and sort of Abu Ghraibing in a certain sense. Although, you know, obviously they weren't locked up for days.
Correct.
And their bones weren't broken. You know, and they were not, you know, forced to engage in sexual behavior.
However, if they can get away with what they did on the 18th with no retribution and no consequences, why not escalate it next time? Why not choke people or beat people?
Let's talk about what they, not just what they did, which is actually quite visible on videos. If you go online to Santa Cruz Indie Media,
the documentation,
visual documentation,
is awesome. Thank everybody who took pictures and video.
Except, of course, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, which didn't seem to have any photos of any of those.
No, the Santa Cruz Sentinel...
I don't think it did.
I don't think they care. I think beating people must be okay for them.
And I didn't see too much in the City on a Hill Press article, which I guess you haven't read yet.
I haven't seen the latest article. They were there at a meeting earlier. I hope they're going to do better.
Yeah. They were their first article. They had three stories I can't really comment on it intelligently because I don't think I have it with me, but I'll take a look again. Maybe I do. But again, the oppression, you know, this kind of attempt to make it difficult for the students. They not only, you know, they not only arrested them and dragged them off to the vehicles, which, you know, could have been done individually. I mean, it would have taken more time.
And lied about the nightclubs, the Billy Clubs, or the Batons, I guess they
call
them.
Officer Eveleth is accused of, by several people, including the victim, of striking a man, Sasha, across the face. Mike Rotkin knows nothing of this, at least didn't when I talked to him about it the next morning, and hasn't gotten back to me on the issue since
then. Glick was hit.
Max Glick was hit?
Yes.
Want to talk about that?
This last Thursday at the meeting, at noon, every day during Monday through Friday, I have went to the chancellor's office and asked if they have the two names that I requested for me.
And those names were?
The names have not been given, the names I asked for was who was responsible for calling the police, and who was responsible specifically for the use of that pain compliance technique which caused the students to go unconscious during arrest.
The knockout approach.
Now, the chancellor has taken responsibility for calling the police and is ultimately responsible for that decision to use that technique. But the actual name of the person who did that is still unknown, and... in the process of the meeting, Liz Irwin came out this Thursday.
And her position is?
She is the UCSC spokesperson, mm-hmm. Public affairs spokesperson. And she was spouting the old lies about no batons were used and how the students were really rowdy and they were smoking pot and they were drinking, which was an out-and-out lie. And I had a small group of students, which I had asked, if anyone wants to come and be a witness and just kind of be a support group for me this Thursday.
Before you go any further, I want to point out that there were no arrests made for urination, defecation, drinking, marijuana, or excessive noise.
Exactly.
Nor were there, and I suppose I heard there were supposedly complaints, but apparently the police and the complainants did not feel it rose to a sufficient level to make a formal arrest.
Correct.
The only arrests were made were for unlawful assembly, trespass, and resisting arrest. Those are the three concerns. Essentially was, we want to disrupt your assembly. If you don't go along with us, we're going to punish you. And though those charges have been dropped, of course, the students face a traumatic aftermath of this whole thing, the threat that it's going to happen again, and, of course, university consequences, expulsion, suspension, and so forth.
Correct. Now, the statement from... the UCSC spokesperson was that the students were growing in number, they were getting increasingly rowdy, they were smoking pot, they were drinking, and that alcoholic containers were found near the child care center, which was near Tent University.
Liz Irwin made these charges.
Liz Irwin,
she made
yes.
these statements on, what? When did she make them?
On NBC, I believe it was Channel 11, the San Jose NBC affiliate, during while students were being arrested. And the fact is that the students were being quite respectful of the neighbors. The noise level was totally very, very, very mild. There was no smoking pot. There was no drinking. The alcoholic beverages that they claimed were there, which were there, were in the woods on the far back side of the granary in the woods, where at any day anyone can walk up there and find a container. They knew those containers had nothing to do with Tent University, yet they made that statement so that they could discredit the Tent University people. So they misrepresented and they lied.
I never saw anyone drinking, and I was around there, you know, back and forth. I wish I had seen anyone smoking marijuana. I think there should have been a medical marijuana tent, and I think that should have been an issue. But I know that that would have been another big shindig and another. It's like they would have said, oh, you're throwing the medical marijuana issue in here. Just like they said, you're throwing the camping issue in. I think all these issues need to be thrown in.
They are important.
Yeah.
One of my responsibilities, which was just an informal volunteer situation, was to mingle in the group, the gathering, and to watch for people who might be smoking pot or might be drinking. So I was very aware of the fact that there was no people not doing not smoking pot and not drinking.
You know, I noticed how respectful people were. There weren't these usual so-called peace monitors you find at the peace protesters who are actually sort of like little adjuncts almost of the police department. Don't you know, get out, stay on the sidewalk, you know, don't go in the street. You know, don't do this, don't do that. Rather, what was done was they said, you know, we don't even tell you not to do drugs. We just tell you we don't endorse the use of drugs here. You know, the point being that it's really up to you. This is we're trying to create a different kind of space where you make the choices about what's best and what's to be done. And I was getting a little nervous as the students were being dragged away and choked into unconsciousness, and some being hit. When the new people started coming in, a lot of people heard about this or saw it on television or heard about it on the radio because we were broadcasting it on free radio.
And joined us.
And joined. They didn't join the people who were being arrested, but they joined the observers.
Correct.
And there was a larger group of people, larger and larger people growing outside. And that, I think, was, of course, the reason they stopped, not because of the deal that Students Against War made privately.
The increasing number of observers.
But they saw that it was like, you know, it was like, you want to say a revolutionary situation, but in a sense, revolutionary in the sense that they realized the numbers of people who were willing to just say no. And the students were not coming and beating up the police. They formed a ring around the police with their arms. And at some point, they blocked the police from taking people to the vehicle. They just stood there. And that was when I think Officer Eveleth went bananas with his baton, although I wasn't exactly on the scene. That's my kind of vague reconstruction of events from what I heard. And that might not be true. I don't want to be unfair to Officer Eveleth and his fine blows against Sasha. And apparently, I don't know if he struck Max Glick. Was it the same officer who struck both these guys? Or
I don't know, who struck Max.
Right. Do you know Sasha's last name?
I don't.
Okay. So there's a couple questions that I'm breaking into my own thoughts here, but I want to give the people who have gone online to Pages in Color, and you can do that, pagesincolor.com, or you can call 427-3772 and ask questions here of Pat True, who's on hunger strike, demanding accountability from the UCSC authorities. And you've got six questions you've asked, and I can read them if you want.
Yes.
But there are two questions that came in on the Internet here on the chat room. Wasn't the highest-ranked officer at Tent U a woman?
I don't know.
I can tell you what I saw. I went over to the right before the officers began to march, I happened to go to a parked vehicle, which was parked right next to the officers. And I saw a woman giving kind of orders to the officers, a woman in uniform. But I don't know if she was the highest or if she was one of the lieutenants, so I can't say there. And secondly, can you comment on reports of vandalism on campus on April 18th, which were probably also made by... Did Irwin also make those comments or not?
That was a comment which was made a little bit later. Before I answer that, let me throw out two things. One is that as I've asked for these names of responsible people, I have found out that there was actually a committee which met making the final decision. And, of course, Chancellor Denton approved their decision. So there's about six people who actually, via committee, made the decision. And I am looking, I hope all of those, and all of those names need to come out into public. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that I understand that the officer that was in charge was the person who made the final decision of what techniques that they would use. So the chancellor may have been aware of the range of things, but did not actually authorize the specific use of that technique. And supposedly the senior officer was the one that made that call.
But Doria, she repudiated it, which is really more to the point, right?
Oh, they're repudiating a lot of stuff.
Have they repudiated the technique? Have they said it will not be used again?
Oh, no, that I have not heard yet.
Well, I don't really care whether she authorized it or not. I care whether, see, obviously, is not. She could have come out the next day and said, this is a mistake, we're going to investigate it.
Right.
Not no such thing has happened, right?
Oh, no, they have said that they would do it again.
Oh, so she essentially stands up for the technique.
Right. They said what they did was appropriate, and they stand
by
it.
The Chancellor made a specific statement, or Liz Irwin made a specific statement?
The Chancellor.
The Chancellor. And when did she make
that
statement?
And I believe that was in the Sentinel. The Chancellor said, we did what we had to do, and we don't regret it.
Okay.
And what was the question? I forgot.
The question was, what about vandalism reports on April
18th? Vandalism, yes. The vandalism... vandalism was interesting. I read that in the Sentinel, and I checked with a couple of people on campus that were aware, you know, that with the maintenance folks and everything. And as I did not hear of any vandalism that occurred on the 18th. However, on about the 19th or the 20th, a round of vandalism began. And for about 3 days, windows were broken. I don't have any verification of this specifically, and I like to have three solid sources, reliable sources to do this, but this is a little bit hearsay.
Rumors.
Rumors. However, I do know one person that said windows were broken at part of the observatory, astronomy lab, where they build some of their gear. I also heard that tires were slashed and that windows were broken. But this appears to me, in my mind, to be more radical students who are responding to the brutality of Monday night.
And the failure to address the brutality.
Right. And the failure to take responsibility for the fact that this was wrong and to admit wrongdoing.
I played tapes about the detailing my observations on the 18th and kind of some of the chants and the incredible situation that developed. And again, the thing that was so empowering was that students had never been arrested before, presumably some of whom had been to this nonviolence training. Did you get to that nonviolence
training?
Correct.
And I should say, I wanted to throw in that the students at the Tent University had nothing to do with the vandalism.
Mm-hmm.
Again, these folks, these young people are totally committed to peaceful changes and a peaceful dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And as was, I guess, David Skolnick, perhaps was the name of the fellow who was doing the training at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on the Sunday before the Monday where this happened. And I, I'm going to lose my thought here, but I have, so.
Let me take that opportunity to jump in here with an update that hasn't been posted. My Friday meeting at noon with the Chancellor's... The day before yesterday. I went to the Chancellor's office with, in addition to my original two questions, I have added five more questions, and those are, who were present at Chancellor Ditton's final committee meeting, which chose to use the police action as a response to resolving the differences between UCSC upper administration and Tent University and Tent University community? Who authorized the police to stop arresting people? And on what grounds was the decision made to stop arresting people? I think that's going to throw some interesting light on this. I think they realized that they were out of line. The last two are, why did the UCSC public affairs officer falsify information given to the television and other news media with respect to no batons were present? And why did they falsify information with respect to the use of drugs and alcohol at the tent gathering?
I would encourage you to rewrite the last two questions by saying something like, is it not, can you provide the documentation for these two allegations? And if they are false, are you prepared to discipline the individual who gave these false statements? Because I'm sure that they'll say they weren't false. So what you really want to do is get their documentation. Well, that's my reaction to that.
That's a very good point. And all of this, my understanding is that they're in the process. The faculty has requested, and the faculty and UCSC upper management are now going to have fact-finding panels set up to try and get as much details as possible and look at future ways of not getting into this.
There was a faculty letter.
I wanted to mention one real quick last thing, though, the update to Friday's meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Chancellor Denton's to the entrance of the office.
As you have been doing every day.
Every day since this last Monday, and I declared my hunger strike publicly. And I had a printout of these questions that I just gave you.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, a small gathering. I've asked people to come and be witnesses and come to support.
That will be happening tomorrow?
Yes.
At what time?
At 12:15.
And where?
At the front entrance at McHenry Library. And I'm not going to go into the door of the Chancellor's office, as we have been doing every day this last week.
Why?
Because
isn't the chancellor supposed to be open to the community?
Because Friday.
Yeah.
And I haven't posted this yet, but I'll get this on my page.
Exclusive, folks.
Exclusive. There were a half a dozen of the library staff came out. People my age, I'm 54,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, of course, I can't say their ages because, you know, they're ladies, and, you know, ladies don't tell their ages.
For heaven's sake.
But
they 2005 or 1883. Anyway, go ahead.
So there's a dozen of us, three or four students, and five or six people from the staff, just mild-mannered people. I went to the door to hand them this thing, and my hand got jarred. The door was locked. The chancellor's office had gone into a lockdown against this meek little quiet group of people. I have to say I was shocked at the paranoia of the chancellor's office. I turned around, I looked at everybody, and they looked at me, and I tried the door again. The door was locked.
What, did they have an out-to-lunch sign-on? That's what Sam Farr used to do when we went to the anti-war protest.
And the receptionist... Linda, whom I know as a person that helps with the copiers around campus, they have a copier, and I have a rapport with her. I was able to convince her to open the door just a crack for just a moment
so
by
you could
asking
slide through the paper
to slide the paper through the door. But I first had to ask everybody to move away from the door.
Step away from the door.
And make
step away from the door.
Make a super promise that nobody would come in the door. Once this had occurred, I turned around and I told this small gathering of friends and supporters, I said, you know, when I'm in the woods, I have this thing. If I'm walking along a path and I come across a creature in the woods, I stop and I back up a little bit to let the creature know that I'm not threatening and let them have their space.
Well, I think there's a difference between a creature in the woods and a combined series of tyrants in positions of power. They're creatures indeed, but they're different
they're
kinds
paranoid.
Of creatures. Well, yeah, but I think that, you know, frankly, I don't think we should respect their paranoia. I think what we need to do is reclaim our public spaces.
Yes, but I want my activities to follow in the spirit of the Tent University, which is to be
right.
positive and peaceful. So we backed away from the door, and starting Monday, we won't be at the door anymore. We'll
but
be out
remember
on the
steps. That one of the proposals, and it isn't mentioned much now, that was discussed on that Monday afternoon before the students decided to camp, was to go directly and occupy a building because of the outrageous threat
yes.
of dispersing Tent University at 8 o'clock that the university carried through on. And that's one of the things that depressed me about the outcome of the Tent University that evening. And they didn't even stay. The students, in spite of the fact that this massive number of people kept coming, there was a great victory celebration. The police dispersed. An inner clique made a decision to disperse Tent University. A group of people went down to the jail in solidarity. Good for them.
Yes.
But you know, you hear Will... you know, saying and others saying, you know, let's leave. Well, some people were saying, why the hell are we going to leave? But the impression being given by the leaders who had orchestrated the whole thing beforehand was, we're going to go to the quarry to get some rest, and everybody can come back tomorrow. And they've allowed us to have five people here through the night, and so we're all going to take off. But the fact is, that space was surrendered. I've mentioned that again and again, but what we haven't discussed
mm-hmm.
is the fact, and I think inappropriately surrendered, the students had won. It was a high point. They should have kept going, you know, to continue to do exactly what they had planned to do, hold the Tent University, maintain the peaceful approach, And I think they could have done it. I think they would have had even more power in doing it because the those who came, who had not been a part of Tent University, recognized that kind of there's a sacred responsibility that comes when power is transferred. It happens in a revolutionary situation. It happens in different places where you feel suddenly more responsible because you have more power. And therefore, I think that would have actually worked that way. But also, and this is, I mean, I'm kind of taking a long trail back to what I'm really trying to say, is this fifth alternative, which was to take over a building and say to the university, we're leaving the building when you assure us we'll be safe and not be brutalized. And I think the students thought they were going to be brutalized. They thought they were going to be arrested. They didn't think they were going to be brutalized.
Cited.
But, you know, not be punished, not have our freedom of speech chilled by essentially occupying this area, which other students have done at other universities in different places in the country.
Recently.
And I think people were sort of timid about doing that. You know, oh, that's going to provoke them. Oh, you know, it's not peaceful. And that's what I'm a little worried when I hear when you saying we're going to back away from the door. The spirit of Tent University was to defend basic rights. And I think occupying a building was a consideration they had, that they should have thought about, this is one way of doing it. In fact, it might have been a very good idea in the sense that it might have put in the students might have, the police might have surrounded the building and said, okay, we're going to leave, go back to your camping area. And then everything would have been able to proceed without chokeholds, or it could have, of course, escalated into something else. But here's a situation where the chancellor, the responsible person, is refusing to give you information and give the community information that we need. And in order to get that information, I would suggest bringing a mass of peaceful students to come and say, well, you know, we'll just wait here until you give us that information. Now, I know that I mean, I'm quarterbacking, and you're doing the work. So, I mean, I'm just throwing that out at you.
Yes, I can tell you that there are a lot of student actions in the wings. So this is far from over. And in fact, unfortunately, the vandalism is a reaction to the police brutality, and that's unrelated to Tent University. This is just independent people who just are sick and tired of being oppressed by our society and by the university, who've just gone off on their own and done this.
Well, when the FCC raided this station, they found that all their tires had been slashed or the air let out of their tires. And I'm sorry, you know, you want to call it vandalism. I call what they did here vandalism.
Well,
you know,
I look at it like karma.
You know, right. So I don't think we need to spend a lot of time saying, we're not a part of that group here, and we're not a part of that group. And I think it's appropriate to say, you know,
well,
the chickens come home to roost.
The overall thing that's happening up there is they have galvanized the students to continue their demonstrations.
They galvanized you. I don't know if they've galvanized. I heard Will Parrish tell me, we got lots of things in the works.
Well, there's other groups up there.
Well, what other actions have been planned? Let me ask you that.
I can't say the actions, but actions are planned. Actions are coming by at least three different student groups who are in solidarity with the labor and who are in solidarity with civil rights abuses.
And the purpose of these actions would be to
change the university. To say the students have the right to express themselves and to demand that the university live up to a higher standard than it's currently living up to.
But they haven't been publicly announced.
Not yet.
Because it seems to me we're talking 2 weeks later, and frankly, I start thinking, you know, the public attention is limited.
Right.
You
know? That's very important.
I mean, I hope you're right.
I'm concerned about that.
You've been doing your thing ever since, and that's
right.
What I find so commendable. And that's one of the reasons I have you here on the show, is I'm thinking this is great. Here's somebody who's willing to put himself out there. And there are some students who've joined you. But it's a handful of people.
Right. In this particular case. But there's going to be more actions coming. And students standing up for their rights, and students telling the UCSC administration and the UC administration. I understand other campuses now, students have started to take up being more militant in a peaceful fashion, more aggressive.
Yeah, see, why is occupying an office not peaceful? I mean, we thought it was perfectly peaceful.
I have
peaceful.
No problem with occupying an office. I think it's a great way to
well,
do
so
it.
Well, so if
in
the
fact,
chancellor doesn't let you in, say, well, we'll stay here until you give us the normal human...
And Fagan, Ginger,
right.
said that one of the greatest things that happened in the labor movement was for people to have a sit-down strike at their machines
right.
such that they couldn't bring in scabs and they couldn't move the machines.
Right. Now, but of course, that I think that could be... Obviously, that was done at different universities like Columbia and other universities in the late 60s. And it's been done, you know, there have been apartheid tent cities, anti-apartheid tent cities in the 80s. But here, I mean, why not say to the chancellor something like, we did this with Representative Farr in 1999. He was supporting Clinton's war bombing of Yugoslavia. And we also did it in 2002 when he refused to sign on against the war in Iraq. And we finally, or actually was voting for military appropriations. And we finally said, his office was locked. We couldn't get into his office. Normally it was open, but it was locked. He you know, out to lunch. I'm not quite sure it was out to lunch, but it was a strange sign. So we said, okay, we'll just wait here in the hallway and stay here. And so eventually they sent out representatives and they met with us and they opened their office. But you see, unless you resist what they do, they feel their tactics, and I think properly so, have beaten you back. Because
yes.
That's what I think of the students on campus. There may be mutterings of this and that and plans and this and that. But look at what's going on. What's going on is charges are dropped. Now the university is running around with a sword of Damocles over people's heads who are involved in the Tent University. And students are not, at least visibly, other than you, doing anything other than talking about it on the Internet. Now, again, I'm not on campus, so I don't know. Is my perspective mistaken here?
I don't think that there is a highly visible reaction, highly visible ongoing action. But as I was mentioning, there are some actions that are in the wings. In addition to student actions, Q is coming up for a strike.
And
Q, the Clericals Union, the UC System-Wide Clericals Union.
Which you're a member of.
Which I'm a member of, and UPTI, which is the technical union. They, I understand, just voted for strike and may be doing a UC system-wide strike. So also, in addition to students being galvanized and more stuff in the wings, that actions that are going to be taking place, and the students asserting themselves and their rights to speak as they need to speak, to raise issues that are important to our society and to UCSC. The workers are also standing up, and they're heartened by the Tent University and the students' stand against the regents, who have been totally unreasonable and totally disrespectful of the employees at UCSC.
Well, in line with that, perhaps now is the point to remind people that today is May 1st, and there are... It's May Day 2005 in Santa Cruz, as I look at the Indie Media website. The Anarchist Day of Remembrance and Rage in the Spirit of Activists Who Were Framed and Murdered by the Government of Chicago on May 1st, 1886. Tragedy of the Haymarket Martyrs. It reminds us of the very real threat of police and government violence towards outspoken individuals. Working people who demand their rights have always felt the fear of retribution. Many activists for human rights, ironically, live with the knowledge they could be imprisoned or killed for standing up and speaking out. Refusal to bow down to these pressures is the driving force behind May Day actions, strikes, and rallies all over the world. In Santa Cruz, according to this, May Day today will include an International Workers' Day parade organized with the support of the Real Work May Day Labor Film Festival. And by the way, do you know if the Labor Film Festival is showing video from this abusive shit that went down on April 18th, the police riot?
Not
police
that I know
riot,
of yet.
Police abuse?
But they are compiling. There's a ton of pictures and a ton of video, and one of the goals was to document the 5 days. And as it turns out, that's going to have a double meaning, not only documenting the wonderful Tent University activities, but the abuse that occurred.
Okay.
So there will be programs coming out of this.
Again, this May Day parade is going to be organized with support of the Real Work, Real spelled R-R-E-E-R-E-E-L, like in Real, movie Real, Work May Day Labor Film Festival, Art and Revolution, and the newly formed Santa Cruz General Membership Branch of the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World. They're going to be gathering in an hour, 11:30 a.m., at the Tom Scribner statue. That's in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, and then march to the town clock. We have a caller. We actually have a caller. All right.
Excellent.
Hi, you're on Free Radio with Pat and Robert.
Hey, Robert.
Hey there, Bob.
Listening to your guest there.
Yes.
Pat, is it?
It is.
Yeah, hi, Pat.
Hi.
Is there, in your opinion, Pat, a rational reason why someone might not agree with your purposes?
I suppose there's always that. Basically speaking, the bottom line is people being just decent and respectful to each other. And if someone has a problem with decency or respect, they could certainly not feel that my point is a good one.
Well, let me retract then. What is the purpose was of Tent University Santa Cruz?
The purpose of Tent University Santa Cruz was to allow young people, students, and community members to get together and discuss issues which are being suppressed by the people in power in our society. For example, the fact that money is being wasted in Iraq that we could and need very desperately in our hospitals, in our school systems, and programs for young people to keep them off of the streets into the negative sides of things that they're getting into, like gangs and such.
I don't see that money being wasted in Iraq is even remotely suppressed. It's a major issue from the financial press to Amy Goodman. I don't agree with you on that at all. There is the normal, quote-unquote, kind of suppression that hierarchies adopt to stay in power, but there's plenty of discussion about Iraq and just the buck level issue, let alone the weapons of mass destruction issue and other perspectives. I have never gotten a grip on the purpose of Tent U, other than to do rather unpolished rants. I mean, that's kind of how I see it.
Well,
I saw the demands in the Sentinel, and they, forgive my language, they appeared crackpot.
Well, you're certainly entitled to that opinion. I think I saw the demands, and I thought that they were reasonably good. This is the whole point is that
okay, you want to eliminate cars on campus. That's a demand.
Well, I didn't say all of them were good. I feel like the fact that they're cutting back on some of the classes and areas of study.
Why are they
doing canceled
that?
The journalism program and the arts programs. I'm not totally up to speed on all of the demands that were made.
Well, let me just, I don't want to waste a lot of the air time
they have
on Robert's show, but just two of the things, journalism and the arts. Now, UC Santa Cruz is making a shift very big time into tech, into biotech. It was key to the Human Genome Project. That's a lot of adoptive optics breakthroughs that are happening up there. A lot of stuff that's going on at UC. Oriented towards science and technology and the future in terms of people being able to function beyond working in the fields.
And I think that
there are not that many places where you can get a history of consciousness PhD and make an income to survive in Santa Cruz.
I agree that science. I am a big fan and a supporter of science, but I would like to see science focused on helping make society better, improving medicine, improving our understanding of the universe, and not for creating bombs and things to use against people.
In my opinion, the forum for that kind of thing, which is a kind of a redirection of social purpose, you could have picked a better forum that would have gotten, I think, better support. The issue has some merit, but I don't know how old you are, but if you look at the changes, even in the last 5 years, the globalization, and that word might be a dirty word to some people, but that's a reality.
Bob, let me interrupt you for a moment because actually we're running into another segment.
Yeah, I just want to say this
before you go that you know the issue we've been really dealing with has not been the specifics. That were going to come out of Tent University in the liberated area.
It was the right to do it.
It was the repression and the right to do it. And I mean, you feel somehow that you're not appalled by what the police did yourself?
Huh? Well, I'll tell you, you know, I haven't been to a farmer's market downtown in a while, but you can't petition like you used to be able to petition, can you?
Oh, you can if you insist on it.
So there is a general kind of a. And I don't necessarily agree with this, a crackdown post 9/11. I think it's becoming kind of clear. I think it's a separate issue from, I have a problem identifying with any of the demands and the whole approach of this scene about helping make society better
by
ranting on the corner of High and Bay.
Well, what about Pat's demand that the police, that the university be accountable for the way it treated people on the night of April 18th?
And the full details come out.
Do you support that demand?
The charges were all dropped, weren't they?
Yes, but that doesn't mean that that the university won't be sanctioning the students, and students aren't afraid of what happened.
Well,
happening.
It doesn't mean that
they
won't try and
do
it again.
If they did they didn't have their permits together, as I understand it. Same thing was conducted. And I don't know how Rutgers did it and other universities do it, but they might have gone through the hoops differently than what appeared to happen here in Santa Cruz.
You know, it's kind of like we're reinventing the wheel with this conversation. I mean, I had this conversation some time ago, you know, with this is a conversation that happened on the first day of
Penn
University.
Well, I mean, that's okay, great. Okay, 30 more seconds. They didn't have their permit act together. It may have been able to have been done even at High and Bay.
It wasn't the students
that
didn't have their. You're wrong. It wasn't the students that didn't have their permit together, and it sounds like you don't have your ducks in a row. I mean, you know, they attempted week after week to negotiate with the university, and the university refused.
They didn't have permits, so it was civil disobedience.
So, in other words, you
Robert.
Need a permit for freedom to assemble. Is that what you're saying, Bob? In other words, you get a permit, or else take your petitions and go home.
They didn't have a permit to operate on the corner.
So you need a permit to engage in
First property.
To engage in First Amendment activity. Is that
it's
what you're
university
saying?
University property.
Okay, so we disagree on that.
It's not like in front of the county building.
This is a form of oppression. They set up the permits in such a fashion as to make it hard for people to assemble and to express themselves.
Now, if you want to go the way of civil disobedience, well, fine. It's like doing a pot smoke-in. You can't do it legally. It's going to have to be done either clandestinely
or
as disobedience.
Right.
They understood that.
Well, Bob, I appreciate your view. Let's see if we got some other
questions. Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
You.
I guess I'm. Well, what do you folks out there think? We got Pat True in the studio. You heard Bob's thoughts calling in 427-3772. For me, trying to justify what the police did is
it's taking us backwards.
Yeah.
If we're not moving forwards, we're moving backwards. And again, I would like to reiterate that I attended a couple of the early meetings with the Tent University planning people, and the one point that was really pressed and was the consensus was 100% that this was going to be a peaceful and a positive, upbeat gathering and event. And for them, for the police to be called on them, and for them to have pain compliance, to not put them unconscious.
Strangulation holds is what it was.
Strangulation holds. Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever unless you feel like that oppression and brutalization is a way of solving problems.
What doesn't make any sense is that the community doesn't seem to understand this.
And the community isn't upset.
Yeah. Well, some people aren't. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Try again, caller. Sorry about that, but you have to give us a minute because we are, you know, kind of wrestling with these issues. Again, to remind you, as I was saying before, this is a march that will begin at the Tom Scribner statue in front of Bookshop Santa Cruz, 11:30 a.m., march to the town clock. Labor organizer Fred Hirsch will speak about struggles faced by local workers, and then people will march to Poet and Patriot for a 1 p.m. screening of The Wobblies. Following that, there'll be a discussion of the future of the labor movement. 6 p.m. at the Portuguese Hall, Monterey Bay Central Labor Council sponsoring another film screening. Workers' Day dinner, discussion with California State Treasurer Phil Angelides and Deborah Berger on the Walmart's war against the workers. So that's all happening today. If you want more information on that, you can go to the Indy Media website, which I am reading off of. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Oh, hi. Are you just screening calls?
Nope. You're on the air.
Okay. I wanted to get back to talking about the decision to bring in the rough cops from UC Berkeley.
Okay. What's your name, caller?
Irwin.
Hey. Okay, Irwin. Go ahead.
I want to know who decided to bring in the enforcers.
Well, that's what we all want to know, right?
Yes, that's my issue.
That's why he shows up every day and he's on the 14th day or 13th day of a hunger strike.
13th day today.
Of a hunger strike. Because the answers aren't forthcoming.
And so what kind of work is being done amongst staff and students to help get answers for this?
Well, I think that right now what I'm doing is I'm going to the chancellor's office, which is in McHenry, the McHenry Library, every day at 12:15, and we're having a peaceful gathering, and we're letting it's important to let the chancellor know that people want these answers, and we want this to be public. On Santa Cruz Indie Media, they have set up a website for me, and I posted the original letter that I sent to the chancellor, and I'm posting updates to the progress of this. You can cut and paste those questions, put them in a letter, and ask and send that letter to the chancellor saying you want the answers. And you can give it to your friends, and they can send in and say they want the answers. It's the entire community needs to send in, needs to send mail to the chancellor, call the chancellor's office, email the chancellors. I don't.
Maybe we can get that phone number. Everybody has a chancellor's.
It's on the UCSC
website,
I believe.
Okay, I'm going to look for that.
I noticed on indiemedia.org there was a petition by faculty.
Yes.
Has there been any efforts to get faculty to support your questions, which I think are a little more pointed than what theirs were, which were sort of let's try and do something in the future? Is there any support from the faculty to do investigative and perhaps disciplinary actions against this particular decision-making process that was very risky to students' health? A chokehold's a real dangerous maneuver to use on anyone, nonviolent offenders in particular. How getting faculty involved for actually doing fact-finding, is there any attempt at doing that?
I believe that I don't know where that is at. I know that they're calling for an investigation, but I don't know that they're calling for an investigation to the degree that they want all of the fine details and that they're going to make this public. I have been in touch with and keeping abreast of the situation, Paul Ortiz. He has a copy of the questions that are online that I mentioned earlier. And I believe that they're moving in that direction. I believe that they're starting to appreciate more that how critical it is to get the exact details and that the university admit wrongdoing so that this can set the make it clear that this cannot happen again.
Obviously, there was you had mentioned that there was a committee that discussed this before, obviously, the event happened, and they probably obviously had to bring in advanced planning to bring in the cops from
right Sunday,
from
as I understand it, the
17th. Trying to get the names of the people who were involved in this would be good, and they probably had to discuss what kind of techniques would be used to suppress, the Tent University people if they didn't agree.
You would think so. The details aren't clear, and I would like to know if those specific techniques were brought up in this meeting or not.
Now, you're a staff member, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know that anything up at UCSC has about, they, especially the people that are involved in this, they're sticklers for procedure. So there were meetings, I'm sure, and they were documented and probably legal. They probably had some sort of legal advice as well, because I don't think if you've worked with any of these people, they have 15 committees just to decide whether or not someone can go to the bathroom. So I'm sure that there were many meetings on this, and it was well documented. The question's just going to be how to get it released.
To be a fly on the wall in the chancellor's office this last week would have been very interesting.
In the vice chancellor's office,
yes.
Student affairs obviously had a big deal with this, because two of the people that were down watching were vice chancellors of student affairs.
And they
yes.
were—they actually kind of infiltrated each of the circles that made the decision whether to camp or not to camp, and they were, of course, almost invariably among the minority that said don't camp. By the way,
right.
the phone number of the chancellor, according to the chancellor's website, the chancellor doesn't have a phone number, of course, but there is an assistant to the chancellor, Marilyn Chapin.
That's a good person to call.
And her number is 459-2058, 459-2058. Her email is mchapin, M-C-H-A-P-I-N, mchapin@ucsc.edu. Chancellor does have an email.
Yes.
It's chancellor@admm.edu. sorry, at Adam, A-A-D-M, dot UCSC dot EDU. Again, Chancellor, C-H-A-N-C-E-L-L-O-R.
She also has...
At ADM dot UCSC dot EDU. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Also, Denton at UCSC dot EDU is an email address for her. But
has she ever returned an email?
I have never seen an email back. I believe it all goes basically to Marilyn. Marilyn is an excellent person to get in touch with. Also, I would like these questions to be sent to the Regents and the Office of the President and to the chancellors of all of the other universities in the UC system.
Well, the City on a Hill Press, the Santa Cruz Sentinel.
The Mercury News.
The Mercury News. Perhaps some radio
Chronicle.
Stations like, you know, KZSC.
I'd also encourage alumni, probably the parents of the students who were involved.
Absolutely.
That, you know, they always get requests for money, and for people to say that they're not going to donate until specific questions are answered about this incident, and also that there's some sort of framework for free speech and nonviolence against students so that there's an assurance that there's a safety of students on campus.
Yes, I applaud that totally. I have encountered, met, or spoke with, rather, folks that I just had bumped into, so to speak, over the course of this last week that turned out to be alumni and who wanted to know all this information and who have been going to the website and taking these questions.
Well, I actually came in contact with a parent whose child was thinking about UCSC, and because of this, doesn't really want to participate in a university that they feel is so shut down in terms of not being responsive to students.
Absolutely.
And being outright aggressive against students for simply exercising free speech.
Caller, were you present on the 18th when all this happened?
No, unfortunately I wasn't.
But you saw videos afterward or heard about it?
I saw the videos, and they were... To me, I was appalled. I know some people that are police officers. I know about chokeholds, and choking someone into unconsciousness is a very dangerous procedure. So I was just appalled to see that that was an authorized technique.
What would the two of you, I'm talking to both you, caller, and you, Pat, do if, I mean, these are all great questions and good suggestions, but again, we're 2 weeks beyond the crime in question, the criminal assault on students, because that's what it was,
yes.
Their assault on their right to assemble, and then the torture to make them give up that right to assemble, which has successfully intimidated them. I mean, let's not kid around. There was no camping for the rest of the week there in any meaningful way.
And the students are afraid.
And people were scurrying to get out of there around 8 o'clock at night in subsequent times. And so, and you know, in spite of all the bravado about, oh, we're going to have more protests and all that sort of thing, it has had a chilling effect. What should people do next?
An observation.
Sure.
I think staff in general has been afraid up at UC for years.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't anything new. People are afraid of losing their jobs. There's a lot of job consolidation. People aren't speaking out. They're afraid if they go against their superiors, they could lose their job because that's the way the system is currently run. So you might get some people who are staff who might say something, but it's going to be very hard to organize staff unless you're organizing with people in the unions who are obviously pissed off about wages. Students, my experience have been, a lot of them have been apathetic. Some are not real familiar with issues. This is, activism is new to them, and this whole consensus sort of fluid list of demands is completely new to them. They're used to having things digested into pithy slogans. And yet,
caller, what happened on April 18th when students who had never been arrested before and saw the torture going on to the person right next to them didn't break and run. They stayed, and they, even though they faced jail, misdemeanor charges for more than 2 years in jail and a $2,000 fine for two charges, they stayed. And it seems to me the critical mass here is if you get enough students together again to say, we demand these answers to these questions. March to the chancellor's office or wherever you want to go, or down to the basic campus and reestablish Tent University, at least until such time as these questions are answered. Then you're going to get, your answer may be more police, of course. That's always
agreed.
A possibility.
And that's going to be the, that's going to be the challenge, is the organization in terms of getting students at the colleges who live on campus, students who live off campus. The campus is very decentralized except for the administration, and so organization will be a challenge, I think, for students to do this. But I think it has to be done, because it obviously did have a chilling effect upon, you know, protests and perhaps future protests. And I think that students, even if they don't understand or even agree with Tent University, and staff, even if they don't understand or agree with Tent University, need to say that this kind of decision-making process behind closed doors, the Cheney approach to running a university, is really not acceptable.
And yet, in spite of all that repression, and we saw it on April 18th, you weren't there, but I was, and you were there, Pat.
Yes.
We saw how students sitting down, peacefully resisting, produced such a cry of outrage throughout the campus that it stopped the police. It really did.
Right.
I know Students Against War did their little deal with the, you know, and the organizers agreed to abandon their whole game and leave, but that wasn't the reason the police left.
Right.
The police left because they knew, just like in 1994 when people were arrested for sitting down on the sidewalk down on Pacific Avenue, that more and more and more would come and sit down. Just like in, you know, the so-called Velvet Revolution and places elsewhere in the world, masses of people come, not violent people, that they come and they say no. And it seems to me that out of that, these numbers, courage comes again. And I saw that courage again on Monday night, on April 18th. It was just amazing.
Yes,
I think that should be applauded. I mean, it definitely was taking action in a positive way, and I think that it can be an inspiration. So I applaud both of you for getting the information out there, for your actions in terms of demanding a response, and also hopefully some staff who, you know, even though they're afraid of their positions, can say, you know what, I don't want to be part of a university that conducts themselves in this way.
Hey, caller, thank you. I'm going to go on to the next caller.
To be honest, one last comment on that. I am unhappy with the response from the unions, that they have not come out and publicly made a statement similar to the way that the faculty did. The unions do have their hands full with fighting the regents, a long, long fight and such, but I would have thought that just a sense of decency would have demanded that they put out some kind of a declaration that that this was bad, that the unions would not accept this kind of behavior on the part of the university.
You're listening to Pat True. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can call in 427-3772. If you want to put a comment out and the phone line's busy, as it occasionally is, it's www.pagesincolor.com. If you want to contact Chancellor Denton and tell her to shape up and give the answers to these questions as to who decided on these compliance holds, how is the process going, is it going to happen again, is it something that they reserve the right to do whenever they feel like it, you can give it. You can email Denton at ucsc.edu or Chancellor at adm.ucsc.edu. If you want to help Pat True, what's the number and a place for support for you, Pat? How can you be reached?
Contact number is 295-2808. That's my cell phone.
Okay, and is there an email address in case people want to save you money on your cell phone?
Yes, time, T-I-M-E, the number 4, and respect. Time for respect, all one words, at yahoo.com.
Okay.
And also you can go to the Santa Cruz Indie Media, and you can post onto the webpage that they've set up for me.
I'm going to invite you to stay on, Pat, while I kind of move into the next segment in the event that callers decide to call back. I do this a lot. I mix my issues, and some people don't like it, and others do. But it's really kind of a realistic recognition that we're not talking, you know, mainstream commercial broadcasting here where we have everything nicely segmented. I kind of do it this way. So you're welcome to stay, and I'm going to be talking now about a couple of other issues tomorrow at the same time that, or actually a couple of hours after, before you go off to the chancellor's office, and again, in your methodical and so far fruitless quest for answers to the questions that I think are only going to come when you have a lot of power with you.
Speaking of a lot of power, the ultimate solution, and they have been using this in Europe, is a general strike.
Hear, hear.
Let's get the staff, let's get the students, let's get the faculty, let's just have a day where we go up to the campus and don't do a damn thing. Same thing can apply in the county, the same thing can apply in the Bay Area, the same thing can apply statewide and national. We need to have a national general strike and say no business as usual. Strength in numbers is the only way to go.
Wow. And so if you want to talk to Pat about that, give him a call at 295-2808 or email him at time4respect@yahoo.com. You can also, of course, reach him here in the studio at 427-3772. 4 hours before you go up to the chancellor tomorrow, I guess at 12:15 at McHenry Library, which is where
yes.
You'll be. The front of McHenry Library, the back, where you're going to be if people want to meet you.
At the front, I don't know which direction is the front.
As it faces the road where you drive up the street.
Faces Science Hill, I guess. The Science Hill side of McHenry Library.
Okay. Okay. You can find him there at 12:15, but 8 o'clock tomorrow morning at the county building, Roger Minch is going to be going to sentencing for his crime of selling medical marijuana to medical marijuana patients with valid medical marijuana cards. He faces 7 years in jail, and some folks may have actually read about this online. It's also on Indy Media. I put up a story. Roger's put up a story. His name is Roger Minch, M-E-N-T-C-H. And I'm actually hoping we can get a hold of him and give him a call. In fact, I'm going to actually try to do that, or maybe we can get my infamous producer to try to do that. See if looks like I got the word that it was we got an answering machine for him, so he may be not available. I'm going to talk a little bit about him, and I think I'm going to play. We're going to talk about medical marijuana generally, and eventually play some excerpts from his discussion with me and Becky Johnson on the issue of his conviction and his trial. Let me zip over here and check out the actual story, which is you can look at it on Indy Media yourself, and it actually is kind of well summarized. It's the second main story, rally for Roger Minch at County Courthouse. Roger Minch, as I said before, a local medical marijuana provider and caregiver, faces up to 7 years imprisonment for he possessed 1.5 ounces of marijuana. They found him because he deposited, $2,000 or $4,000, $2,000 to $4,000 in a bank, and it smelled like marijuana. So they thought something smelled funny.
Smelled funny.
They never demonstrated that the money he received wasn't beyond what will be required for servicing those patients, but they claimed he was not a caregiver. That's what the instruction Judge Stevens gave to the jury. There are a number of letters to the court, and you can write a letter on his behalf as well. He's going to be in front of the courthouse at 8 o'clock tomorrow, going into court 8:30 in Department 4, the court of Judge Samuel Stevens at 701 Ocean. And the, the letters that he has received, I'm looking for the, let's see if the letters are here. They're actually online. And I'm going to have to find those. Let's see. There's a couple of sometimes a little difficult to get these stories here. Here's some commentary on his case. Roger Minch was clearly a medical marijuana patient. This is Becky Johnson writing online. All the people he provided to, five of them, were all legitimate marijuana patients. Jurors noted that when they examined Roger Minch's financial records for a year, that if he made any money from the sales, it was not much. Proposition 215 provides for legalizing caregivers for medical marijuana. AB 420, the state law, which was passed after Minch's arrest, provides for reasonable compensation to medical marijuana providers for their costs. Minch's fees appear to have fit this guideline. Why did Bob Lee prosecute this case in the first place? Why didn't Judge Sam Stevens allow the jury to consider whether Mensch qualified as a medical marijuana provider? Why does any jury in Santa Cruz County ever convict people for growing, using, or distributing medical marijuana in Santa Cruz County? Demand justice for Roger Mensch. No jail for Roger Mensch. You have any thoughts on any of this, Pat? You're welcome to co-host this if you want.
Okay. Well, I can say that I'm definitely sympathetic to medical marijuana. Marijuana, as I understand it, has been part of societies going back thousands of years and has proven to be a useful crop with respect to, obviously, clothing, oils, cooking support, and medicinal purposes.
Right. I mean, I think you're frankly, I think the whole drug war, even for, you know, drugs that are not necessarily particularly beneficial, is vast, you know, creates a vast black market, corrupts the police departments, you know, allows the CIA
marijuana
to move a lot of money around.
Marijuana yeah. has a history of,
yeah.
of benefits that is undeniable.
Right.
As opposed to drugs that are put on the market and then found in less than 3 to 5 years later to be causing heart problems and all this kind of stuff. We have all this medicine that's entirely experimental, and we have something that's been has a proven track record. I don't get it.
Yeah, I'm looking at a couple. There are letters online. One I've already read from Mayor Mike Rotkin, who I feel has really fallen down. He's been a real obstruction to any kind of medical marijuana clubs here in Santa Cruz. But he does support Roger Mensch, even though I think he just met Roger Mensch recently. He says, I'm writing with respect to Roger Mensch. I believe the local criminal justice system is quite judicious and wise. This doesn't sound like much of a support for him. Done a good job. I've met with Mr. Mensch, spoken with him as a reasonable and gentle person whose views about the need for medical marijuana were thoughtful and persuasive. He's an actual medical marijuana provider. He has a patient living in his home. He's been providing home care for this individual as well as another individual for some time now. Rotkin says he's received phone messages from two medical marijuana patients telling me they were among those receiving medical marijuana from Mensch before his arrest. He hopes he'll be lenient. He hopes Judge Stevens will be lenient, does Mike Rotkin, in the sentencing of Mensch. And that's good. Thank you, Mike. And I actually thanked him on the air
yes.
and in person for that letter.
Thank you, Mike. Us also.
Now let's see if you can maybe give a letter to deal with, you know, the police and get them to be a little more lenient on people and have a little stricter policy regarding how the Santa Cruz police, such as Officer Eveleth, are allowed to engage in what appears to be inappropriate behavior up at UCSC on April 18th. But
in violation of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights.
Or at least, the International Covenants, as Anne Fagan Ginger wants to remind us, are more useful than
which have been signed and ratified.
Yeah. There's another letter here. This is a letter about the Mensch case from Dale H. Geringer, Ph.D., coordinator of California Normal. I'm writing you regarding the case of Roger Mensch, charged with illegal cultivation of marijuana. We first heard from Mensch before his arrest when he called our office about establishing a medical marijuana facility. He made it clear he wanted to operate legally in accordance with Proposition 215 and Health and Safety Code 11362.7. Like many similar defendants, he was unclear on the extent to which current law protects caregivers, apparently not much in Santa Cruz County. We were unable to clear up this uncertainty due to the fact that different courts have come to sharply conflicting conclusions. For example, in one case, a Sonoma County jury acquitted two men for growing over 900 plants as caregivers for a San Francisco cannabis dispensary. In another, an Orange County patient was sentenced to state prison for providing less than an ounce of medical marijuana. It's our impression that Mr. Mensch always intended to operate legally. When he first called us, he expressed an interest in setting up a patient's caregiver facility in Mountain View. He went on to cancel this plan when local authorities indicated they wouldn't permit it. Given the drastic uncertainty in current law, it would be inappropriate to give Mr. Mensch a harsh sentence. We urge your clemency. Here's another letter from Marcus L. Brown, professor, psychologist, and priest emeritus. My retirement, writes Professor Brown, or Reverend Brown, came as a result of at the expense of his health. He's 100% disabled, as classified by the Vets Administration, Social Security, and other agencies. He was wounded 4 times in the head, right shoulder, and both knees. Major surgery in Vietnam as a member of the Special Forces, aviation and Cambodian invasion in 1970s, serious auto accident in 96 with complications leading to major surgery, thoracoctomy. It's a word I've never seen before. Discectomy and spinal cord repair, 2001, genetic malformation of the matrix, both hands and feet, infectious ingrown nails protruding through backsides of digits. Wow.
Ouch.
2005, complex dual team surgery, tentatively scheduled for May 2005. Nonetheless, my major diagnosis from several sources is chronic pain. I have been prescribed many things, over 36 different medications over the 30-plus years, and cannabis, medical marijuana, is one of the only remedies that help at this point in my search for relief. Among those who produce, manufacture, distribute, sell, or use this controversial remedy, Mr. Roger Mensch was and has been a godsend. I have been taken advantage of by other legal distributors charging 33% more for the same high-quality product. By the way, in my research, only the premium grades have the lasting, and only a few hours at that, of pain relief. When I use this medication in combination with the other prescribed regimen, I'm able to function still with pain, but muted so I can have a little relief at least for a little while. Not only has the cost been prohibitive, now being solely on government disability benefits, but the access also. Here again, for almost a year now, Mr. Mensch has gone out of his way to be accommodating, communicative, and helpful as a caregiver. I found him to be trustworthy, compassionate, and principled, with a desire to help others who are hurting. He's filled with a comprehensive base of knowledge about cannabis and the medical benefits, as well as horticultural expertise. He's been professional, polite, and even transparent. I'm skipping through this letter. People can read it online at Santa Cruz Indy Media. And there is another one from Matthew Roth, another person he was a caregiver for. This guy had a herniated L5 disc in his lower back, herniated into the S1 nerve, and severe nerve pain all the way to the bottom of his foot. He'd been taking legal prescriptions. These meds caused him to become chemically and physically addicted to them. He was a storage design architect with a major computer and storage manufacturer. He became concerned he was becoming addicted, so he went to non-addictive ways to deal with his pain. Medical marijuana is what he used. He's now able to dose himself exactly to where comfort level needs to be. He says again, Mr. Mensch was a godsend. He provided me with a way to keep himself safer and ease his suffering. He urges Judge Stevens to look at Mr. Mensch as a provider of a natural way to manage pain and suffering and not as a criminal. I know, as he would not even deal with me until I physically showed him my recommendation from a doctor to prove that it was legal for him to deal with a caregiver. And I have also written a letter, which people can read online, which is somewhat harsher. I think Stevens essentially twisted the jury so that they couldn't find him not guilty because he refused to allow Mensch to come in under the definition of caregiver because of a bizarre interpretation by claiming that you have to provide for health, safety, and housing as well to be a caregiver. In fact, it's one of the three. In fact, I think I have one of those three wrong, but he made a legal error in my mind. I don't understand why, but maybe I do. I mean, I don't know. You can never underestimate the incompetence, arrogance, lack of sensitivity. I mean, these are judges who every day are ruining people's lives in the drug war. And I'm not just talking about this very thin segment of it, which is medical marijuana. They've sliced us off into segments, folks. I say this again and again. It's not just medical marijuana. It's not just marijuana. It's the whole drug war that is putting hundreds of thousands, millions of people in jail. And I actually wrote a letter to D.A. Bob Lee, which I'm going to deliver tomorrow when I go to this Mensch rally on 8 o'clock in the morning, which says something like, I haven't finished it, but it begins, in the past you've been helpful in providing informal information. Well, I'm asking him for stats. And I ask for how many charges have you filed involving either sale, use, or possession of marijuana against how many individuals, this is since he became D.A. and I guess in 2002, how many cases were prosecuted? How many convictions? How many cases were referred to drug diversion and drug court? What's the average cost of a typical case? How many of it involved jury trials? How many of the trials involved acquittals? And what were the stats for these before you came to office? In other words, have you been dropping the drug war against marijuana, intensifying it, or simply continuing it and causing the misery to go on and on and on? And you don't see a lot of marijuana cases directly in court. What I saw the other day when I went to the Jerry Henry case, and Jerry Henry is a case which Pat may not know about. Looks like Pat's about to take off.
I want to thank you, Robert, for having me on the air, and the folks that called in, contacted, and all the people that have been supporting me. My support goes out to this case also. It's time we had a more humane and more compassionate society. And if you're not working actively and really rolling up your sleeves, we're going to be going backwards here.
So tomorrow at 8 o'clock, check it out in front of the county building. And tomorrow at 12:15, check out Pat and his patient mission to the chancellor's office to get some information.
And I'm headed over to the labor rally at the clock tower.
All right. You want to talk to Pat? He'll be there. He's in a he has a purple multicolored cap on with a unity button and a peace button on, and he's got a blue Hawaiian shirt and shorts. So you can't miss him. And don't feed him anything, though. He's on a liquid diet.
And I don't mind if you eat in front of me. It doesn't bother me.
grab that hamburger and just eat your heart out, Pat. Or the veggie burger. Hey, thanks, Pat.
Thanks, Robert.
All right, man. Again, reminding folks, 101.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Call-in lines open, 427-3772. I'm talking about Roger Mensch and about looking to see what the stats are around the drug war and what's been going down. So, I don't know. We'll see if Bob Lee responds. I'm making it as an informal request that will become a Public Records Act formal request if he refuses to honor an informal request. I made a couple of requests to other city council members, actually, earlier this week to jump a little bit into another subject. Not entirely. I asked Mike Rotkin to follow up on what he said he would do a week and a half ago, which is find out if the closing of the Pacific Coast Cooperative, the Matt Hilliard, Peter Koch medical marijuana dispensary that opened across from the bus station on Pacific Avenue, could be reopened by changing the law with an emergency ordinance that would essentially allow it to operate down in that in district as a specific place by very carefully saying you got to be upstairs, you got to be indoors, you got to be here, you got to be there, in order to open it up as a stopgap measure while the city is dicking around, supposedly trying to re-examine the medical marijuana laws, which they're not, by the way. I hear this refrain from Rotkin, but I don't see any evidence that he is. He made the same claim in November of 2003. He is that he was looking it over, is going to reform it. You know, he gave a speech about it. It's a lot of hot air, folks. Until you see some substance, it's hot air. He's off, you know, parading before the UN with some Women's International League for Peace and Freedom funded junket. So, you know, thanks, Mike. I suppose, you know, I mean, it's probably a cause I agree with, but I can't stand these public posturings on national issues while he lets local human rights rot away. It just and people suffer here in this city because of that. So it's not something that I find pleasant. And I don't think you should either. Give him a call, 420-5023, and call him today. Leave a message on his phone to get off the stick on the medical marijuana situation. And if you've called before, call him again if he hasn't called you back. 420-5023. Leave your phone number and see what's cooking with that. Time now for a brief musical break, after which I'll be back.
Well, mister, I just overheard you talking through your drink. How the Russians lie like rugs, how they've pushed us to the brink. Now sit right here beside me. I've an old man's tale to tell. Our Yanks and Reds were friends once at the L. My name is Joe Pulowski, I hitched up in 41. Left my sweetheart in Chicago and I learned to fire a gun. The fog in the Ardennes so thick you could not see your nose, nor the ghosts in the Belgian wood advancing through the snow. We left our dead behind us and we scaled the dragon's teeth. With screaming memes overhead, not one of us could sleep. Some fell to the enemy, some fell to the creeping cold, and I killed a German sniper who was not 14 years old. The soldier takes a hit, my friend, it ain't like Hollywood. Bone and guts go flying, and everywhere there's blood. For a moment he is mystified, there must be some mistake, as it all drains out in a crimson lake. Will turn the weather and likewise the tide of war.
as haggard, hungry Germans surrendered by the score. And thank God for the Russians who took the battle's brunt and broke the back of the Wehrmacht along the eastern front. And we saw a burst of lilacs and the river swift and wide, and rest and welcome waiting for us on the other side. And Yanks and Reds laughed out loud to be alive at the Elbe. We caught the glint of water, and upon the distant shore, men and trucks and horses, not German and not ours. No bridge to cross, but at the dock, a boat securely tied. We blew the chain and rode like demons for the other side. When we stepped upon the land, oh Jesus, what a sight! Blackened bodies of civilians, like driftwood piled high, cut down by stray artillery, what the hell is it all for? We knelt and cursed the cruelty and madness men call war. Three Russians approached us, we shook hands and then embraced. Stalingrad traced its lines of sadness on their face. Upon that field of corpses, these weary, happy men swore an oath that it must never happen again. Then we wept and cheered and spoke in languages unknown. They poured us Russian vodka, by God we drank it down. We sang the Volga Boatman, they sang Tavern in the Town. And I never kissed so many men as on that afternoon. When we saw a burst of lilacs and the river swift and wide, and rest and welcome waiting for us on the other side. And Yanks and Reds laughed out loud to be alive at the Elbe. But no sooner were we stateside than the Cold War headlines read. Commies in the unions, commies under every bed. Hurrah, the Nazi devil's down, long live the devil red. And not one word about the oath we swore amongst the dead. There are kids today who'll tell you we fought Russia in the war. There are armchair heroes set to settle some old score. There are profiteers and pushers primed to send young men once more to blow themselves to glory on some godforsaken shore. To drape my coffin with the flag of the good old USA, it's Yanks in army khaki and Reds in Russian gray. Lower me so gently into the German clay and speak again the oath we swore that day. When we saw a burst of lilacs and the river swift and wide, and rested well waiting for us on the other side. And Yanks and Reds laughed out loud to be alive at the Elbe. At the Elbe.
At the Elbe, Fred Small. So, city council meetings have been kind of tedious to watch. They're always pretty tedious. And I've been mentioning recently that public comment has been cut back more and more. The last city council meeting last Tuesday, I got a video copy of. Hats off to Huff member Valerie, who got it for me. It has, of course, oral communications on it, but not in the evening at 7 o'clock when you might actually be able to show up for it, but in the afternoon at the end of the council session at a time uncertain. And there were still a few people who were able to get down and who talked about medical marijuana, the same thing that was talked about 2 weeks before by a whole list of care providers, including the MaryMed person, the Pacific Coast Cooperative folks whose club was closed, Andrea Tischler of the Compassion Flower Inn. I spoke about it. There were people talked about it. A great number of people talked about it. Great number of 7 or 8. Considerable number of people at oral communications. And the conversation continued. I'm going to play that. You're going to hear some familiar voices there. The first speaker, I don't actually have her name, but she made some strong charges against WHAM. And we're going to start towards the end of her speech. And then you're going to hear Michael Tomasi speaking, who... is always irrepressible, sometimes makes me wince, but I also, looking over his speeches later, I find myself thinking, yeah, that's true. You know, I may find you a little bit rough in your delivery, but you're willing to say things nobody else is, just like some people say that I do that. He does that for me in a way that I may do that for some others. So here's city council meeting from last Tuesday at the elusive oral communications period.
clubs. They need to give that money to this town if they want to operate.
Yeah.
Not one person like the Corral should have that place on the hill and growing pot. And if they don't want to do that, then somebody needs to claim eminent domain on that land, take it over. There's many ex-WAM members who want to do just that, take it over and do good things in medical marijuana. And this whole town, this whole state could run itself. You put that money in account, and you could just, like, live off the interest. Just the interest would pay for everything, roads, potholes, whatever. And since you don't want to talk to me, you don't want to respond, I was told I better come public. Then you have no choice. And I don't do things like this. Believe me, you can hear in my voice. I'm just terrified. But anyway, and I thought that said city attorney. Okay, you're a lawyer. What do you do about a pedophile?
You're supposed to address the council's hall.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Just all right, you need an attorney. And as of today, the CDC has announced that there's 800 more AIDS victims since all the AIDS programs have been closed down. I know SCAP only lost 40% of their people. Equidox is completely closed down. So now the Corrals have to get 800 more people to join their project because it's all you need is AIDS or hepatitis to join. That's 800 more people to give money to this town every Tuesday night, Wednesday night, whatever. Whatever pot club they go to, it should go
your
to time
this is up.
Time. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. I didn't get something earlier, but I'll be happy to respond once I open it up and read it.
This is originally this woman began with a claim that she wanted to give Michael a communication, and Michael Rotkin said, hand it to Leslie Cook, the city clerk. And she said, well, I did that before, and you didn't get it. So Rotkin came down and took it from her. Here's the next speaker.
Mr. Tomasi.
Mayor Rotkin, City Council. My name is Mike Tomasi. King of marijuana. I hold my hand up for freedom. I grab it and I squeeze hard.
What he's doing here is he's holding up a joint. You can see it on the television. It's quite clear.
Rights for all of humanity. For the Constitution of the United States. And for all amendments. For the right to be able to stand here, to be able to come to this city hall on 420 day, I thank you. I sat out there and I smoked pot until I had calluses from striking my lighter in front of your city hall with the Santa Cruz Police Department sitting right next to me with Mr. Bruce, the cop, coming over and saying, Mike, what are you doing? I said, I'm smoking a dude. He says, Mike, it's all right. 420 on 420. I went and sat in front of your Santa Cruz Police Department, and I was sitting there burning happily and smiling and saluting people and telling them I love them very much and trying to make sense of all this ridiculous voting that we did for medical marijuana. All of us voted it in, but all of us take it back out. You won't have no club except for Valley Corral's club, which the lady just said is no good. But I'll tell you what, if you really want a compassionate way of taking care of selling marijuana, which I've done for 36 years, and I have never been arrested for it because I didn't lie, and I didn't cheat, and I didn't steal from people, and I was good to people. Understand that, because I'm also proud of selling pot for 36 years and not getting busted, as no, well as I am.
You realize you're on television and announcing that you may be putting yourself at some risk.
Well, you know what? Whatever risk comes to me, I'm sure that I can stand up and I won't fall. Because, you know, I'm going to tell you something, Mayor. Being the king of the trolls of A Battery, 6th Battalion, 14th Artillery, was the greatest honor of my life. Because you know something? I'm alive. And as long as I'm alive, I'm going to fight against people that teach hate, discrimination, and selective enforcement. And I'm also going to do this. I'm going to make sure that people will be protected and served that don't fit into your mold. And I don't know how I'm going to do it. But remember the Lord said, Mike, you must fight for your rights. And then you must fight against hatred of all of humanity. and that's what I'm doing. And if it's not good enough for you, I'll throw so much love at you, it'll ignite and blow you right out of your chair, sir.
Thanks very much.
Sir, may love go with all of you and your spirits.
Thank you. Other members of the public want to talk to us at oral communication? Please come up.
Hello, my name is Dave Anderson. I've been a volunteer ranger at Wilder Ranch since 1989, and my wife has convinced me to purchase a home in Santa Cruz. I have a home on Raymond Street. I'm concerned with the level of drugs and gang activity in the Beach Flat area. I've been to two homeowner meetings. The first one was really nice. There was lots of people there. The Spanish people were there. And we were starting to get things done. And then on this last Tuesday, I showed up early, and I had Sears come by the house to fix a washing machine. I sent my wife down to the corner of Lambert and River Street, and a drug dealer came out and tried to sell us some drugs. I walked down to the boardwalk to get some dinner, came back, same drug dealer, tried to get both of us, started after both of us. And the only reason we were saved is that the lieutenant came around the corner to go to the meeting. It's a nice area. You've done a lot of work. You've got a nice community there. You put a lot of money in there. You put a lot of money into the Riverwalk. Unfortunately, when anybody comes to town, they stop right at that corner. And the drug dealers come out. It's almost like going to a Burger King. What do you want? Oh, step up to the next window. Make your payment. Step up to the next window. Collect your drugs. Can you help us out? The lieutenant said that we could, you know, he would like to have a couple of policemen there full time. I talked to the ranger that is in charge of the Wilder. And he was down here 6 or 8 years ago. And he said they had two policemen down there. And they cleaned it up. It was really nice. The drug dealers left. You know, in the 50s, the police chief was here. There was no problem. A lot of the neighbors, a lot of the Mexican-Americans didn't show up because they were afraid. There were eight people attacking three other people. And nobody saw anything. In the middle of the day, they're all afraid. Can you help us out? And you were talking about the health care. Well, I'm sure that the medevac helicopters that landed here to take those two people away probably ran $30,000 to $50,000. And this would be another savings. So that's what I'm here for, is to ask for some police help. And members of your council, I hope you can help us out, because we really need it. We can't do anything without you, because everybody's afraid. I'm afraid of walking down the street. Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming down and sharing your concerns.
And actually, just as Mike Rotkin and the city council had absolutely nothing to say about medical marijuana 2 weeks before, when everybody was talking about it, and here's more commentary about it, and you'll hear another speaker, Andrea Tischler, in a moment. So likewise, the city council had nothing to say about it during this council session last Tuesday. But they did spend some time talking about the police and how they want to reassure people about the drug war. So the idea that somehow the police are the solution to the drug war, which is the big lie, and we all know it, is something they continue to promulgate locally, that police action is the way to go with the drug war. More cops and more sympathizing with this fear. Instead of recognizing it, unless you medicalize the problem, it's never going to end. Anyway, that's my view. Let's hear some more of this, and then we're going to have a caller who called in during the tape-in. She'll be calling in talking about some problems she's had with Wham.
Are there other members of the public who want to comment or oral communication? Please come up. Good afternoon. You can sign up afterwards. That's fine. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Andrea Tischler, and I've been here before. And I just listened to the gentleman. I just came in at the last part of oral communication. Where was that? Where did that happen?
Yeah,
No, no.
He's talking about Raymond Street in the Beach Flats neighborhood.
Okay, that area. Because we've been working with the police also in the Laurel, with Ed Porter, also with Jim Howe, and trying to make the neighborhood safer. And one of the things that we do notice is just what he was describing, that there's a lot of drug dealing going on out of the streets. And I'm concerned about that. You know that I'm a medical marijuana advocate, and I'm not speaking for the drug pushers out there. I'm speaking for the medical marijuana patients. And what we really need in this town is to take the drugs off the street and put it into a safe clinical situation where cannabis is purchased in a safe and a private place, and not on the streets. Every time I walk down Pacific Avenue, I notice also across the street from the bus station. And this dispensary that was operating down there was stopping a lot of that drug trade. And that's why it's important for the city of Santa Cruz to adopt or change in some way the ordinance and come forth with a more of a possibility of a dispensary being located in Santa Cruz. I'm sure you've been reading the newspaper about San Francisco. Well, they have 43 co-ops and dispensaries in that town, and it's not right for our 4,000 patients or more to have to go up there in order to get their medicine. It's incumbent on you, I think, to allow and make a more favorable environment for medical marijuana patients and dispensaries. You've come out on record in support of this with the WAM organization. Now we need other dispensaries. As you know, WAM only accommodates 200 patients, and we've got many more than that in this county. And the bus station is a perfect place. The bus terminal is a perfect place for people who come in wheelchairs, come from other places in the county, and also within our city. And for them to have to get back on another bus and go out to some industrial zone, I think that's just asking a bit too much. That's not the kind of kind and
your time is up.
You're in support of medical marijuana patients, so do something about it. And
that's it.
Please.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else who have oral communication? I have a brief oral communication. Beginning this next month, May 2nd, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, I'm going to be in New York City at the United Nations, first at a march and rally in the city, and then at the United Nations itself, along with another, I guess, 99, because there's 100 of us total, mayors in the United States to support a demand for nuclear disarmament now. This is not being paid for by the city. The members of the Women for, International WILF, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, is paying for my air ticket, and I'm paying for the rest of it myself. But I'm proud to go represent the city of Santa Cruz. It
would be nice if you talked about disarming our local police or investigating their use of tasers, disarming them in the sense of disarming, keeping a closer look at when they're using force and so forth. He won't open those records, but he's all hot for international nuclear disarmament, which I am too, of course. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM. On the air, that was the Tuesday City Council meeting just last Tuesday. I have here on the phone a caller who just called in who has got some concerns about WAM. Hi, caller. Are you there? Hello, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll turn my phone up a little bit, so if I'm talking too loud, just say so.
Okay. I can hear you.
Okay.
Yeah, just make sure your radio is not, otherwise it'll confuse you.
I turn that off.
Okay.
Okay.
So you actually spoke earlier at this same city council meeting
that Andrea spoke at
right before Andrea,
right.
And then the earlier speaker concerned about the harassment by drug dealers in his neighborhood.
Right. Let's just say everything Andrea says is true, and I'm on her side.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good thing, yes. And what she said about you're supposed to support medical marijuana users and not have you traipsing all over town and industrial areas,
mm-hmm.
that was one of my main concerns, too.
Now, are you a medical marijuana user yourself?
I was. I dropped out because I found out the hard way that the corrals are very abusive.
Now, the corrals are the people who run Wham.
Right. Mike and Valerie Corral are very abusive people. Period, end of sentence. They're money grubbers and all these, like I say, so-called donations. They're down there pulling money out of people every week, and then they're like the perfect touch. And like I said before, what they do is what the military calls psyops. These people are drugged, cancer, AIDS, whatever their medical problem is. They're tired. Some of them are well enough to go to work. They come down there in the evening. They're tired. They just want to get their medicine. They want to get out. So they're ripe for the picking, psyops, and they just pull the money out of you. And if you don't have the money, oh, boy.
Well, I thought that one concern of the corrals, and by the way, Valerie Corral has been invited to appear repeatedly on my show, and she has called me back three times and said that she would like to do that, but she's not sure when, so there's a possibility at some point in a future show she may well be on. And if you're listening in, Valerie, or any other WHAM members or members of the public, of course, you're welcome to call in. 427-3772. You can't get in while June here is on the line. That's your name, right, June?
Mm-hmm. June, just like the month, yeah.
But you can jump on the chat room at www.pagesincolor.com, and you can address questions and comments there. You can, of course, call up after June is off the line. So you're making some pretty serious allegations here, June. One of the things Valerie Corral has said, that one of her differences with earlier cannabis clubs has been she says that she does not favor, the buying and selling of marijuana because it encourages profiteering. Rather, she favors a more cooperative, collective approach. Isn't that what WHAM has?
Well, then why is she calling my house screaming at me? I give nobody nothing for free, and nobody does nothing for me for free. That's why she's not an all-volunteer organization. She gives living wages. And this is the truth.
Well, now let me understand. How does it operate in WHAM? What's the process by which people get their medical marijuana?
We go down there. We have to go through this whole silly meeting of hers where she's pulling money out of people. She starts every meeting with donations are down, donations are down. And then it goes to the van. We need money for the van that was given for free, the labor and parts that are given for free. But there's a hat put in the middle of the floor because we got to get the van up and running. And then it's the Mike and Val legal fund. Now, I heard that the lawyers are pro bono. They're all for this. They're going to work for them for free. Yet we have to pay the lawyers. So which is it? And then the guns. I guess in 2002 at the raid, Mike said those guns were like an inheritance.
His dad died a few months ago. Wait, but the guns, you mean there were some guns seized by the federal government or something?
Yes, and the guns are returned because he claimed they were a gift, an inheritance from his father. Okay, cool. We all understand that. And I guess they're antique guns, whatever, I don't care. But I heard recently his dad just died a few months ago. So, did his dad die long ago, and that was the inheritance, or did his dad just die?
I'm not sure I understand what the point of this is. What you mean, people are there? What you say? There's a call for donations at every WHAM meeting. Some of it goes to a van. Some of it goes to legal fund.
Oh, and then there's the.
Well, what does the guns have to do with anything?
I'm just saying they're liars. They've somehow. It's like a massive ball of confusion, mm-hmm. and any shrink will tell you what comes out of confusion.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, how many people come to these meetings?
It varies. You got the group that goes there because it's a social thing. They see their friends, all this sort of stuff, right? Uh-huh. It's like the only day of the week they can get out of bed to go socialize. And then you got the group that comes in at the very last minute. They run in, get their medicine, and leave. They don't participate in nothing. They just come in, give the money, and go.
And how long have you been attending these meetings?
From 1997 to 2003.
But you must have felt that they were productive, or you wouldn't have continued to attend them, right?
I need medical marijuana, and it was cheap, so I went. But
so there was not profiteering. You say it was cheap. So, I mean, why are you accusing them of profiteering?
Because I know they are. They are profiteering. And then you got all the little side things that go on. We got the caregiver system. I can't get there. I send someone in. they want half your medicine plus $10 to deliver. We tried to get her to stop this, and it's like, now that's okay. So there's all kinds of little branches of this whole thing going on, right?
So
they're growing marijuana up there in Davenport, and they're bringing it down here to the Viking Hall and selling it, and plain and simple. And they need to give the money to the city, and they're not doing that. So where's the money? And I have asked this and asked this and asked.
Why do you say they need? You say you think it would be a better idea if the city handled this? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and they take the money and open these AIDS projects back up. Like I said, I don't have AIDS. I have MS and I have hepatitis.
Uh-huh.
But they've closed down the AIDS projects, and they got the CDC announced Tuesday morning. What a fluke! I'm on my way down there. And they announced 800 new AIDS victims in Santa Cruz.
You mentioned that, Jan, in your speech.
Right.
At the, but,
so we need to get these programs up and running, but the city council claims there's not enough money.
Are you suggesting, I mean, that costs a lot of money. Are you suggesting that the corrals are taking in, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars? I mean,
I don't know how much, but I know it's a lot.
Because remember, we're talking about people who indeed are fighting the federal government. While it may be possible for attorneys to be pro bono, there are also going to be legal fees, legal costs. I know this. I have attorneys who are pro bono working on my case, but, you know, they still have to find some way to file papers, do depositions. That this costs a lot of money somewhere along the road. So do you think you're being entirely fair here? I mean, you feel strongly about it. It sounds like you had a strong argument with Valerie Correll.
Oh, God, have we ever. Yeah. I told her she's not allowed to call my house anymore. I mean, the woman gives me nightmares. She's so freaky, and so.
Well, I don't want to try to, you know, air so much a personal or public dispute. I'm more concerned about issues. My concerns with WHAM has been that they have not come out for a cannabis dispensary in Santa Cruz. That essentially, there has been no dispensary since 2000,
right,
when the last one was closed. Essentially,
right,
because of the law which they helped to. They were a party to writing, or at least they were consulted in the writing of,
right,
and they haven't spoken out about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I admit over the years I've heard some more concerns about WHAM, ranging from, you know, cult activity. Some
that
people
too,
have described
yeah,
it as cult activity.
It's a pot cult, and I've been
well,
part of the
you know,
pot cult
I mean,
for
I,
years.
I, freedom of religion is fine. I've got no objection with that.
Right.
And I've heard concerns from others about violence by some people in authoritative positions in WHAM.
Yes, I heard that too.
But you know, these are all rumors, and then every group has its, you know, problems,
right,
and it has its people who object and people who leave, and there are people who have differences of opinion.
Right.
You know, and my general perspective on WHAM has been, I'm glad that they do what they do. Except I'm extremely upset that as a group which has a lot of public force, has a high public position, has a lot of support in the community, and not just this community, but in other communities too,
right,
that they could do a lot to change our local situation,
right,
by making it legal for dispensaries to open, by pressuring,
right,
the city council to do that.
Yeah.
But you have some, I mean, do you have any actual documented concerns about WHAM, or are you simply giving kind of impressions that you have?
Well, all I know is what I've seen and what I've heard in the years that I was there. And she can, and like, people say, did you hear that veiled threat? And I go, oh, what? She said, no, right? But then over the years, I go, oh, maybe that is a veiled threat. And then sick people, dying people, and it's like, now I'm going to make you jump through my hoops.
Wait a minute, say that again. Six people what?
Okay, you got sick and dying people down there.
Right.
And you've got her saying things like, now you're going to jump through my hoops to get your medicine. Why make such statements?
Maybe she was being, you're talking about Valerie?
Yeah.
So she said that you're going to jump through my hoop. Well,
she gives her whole little speech every week, and then, not always, but sometimes she has said, okay, now you're going to jump through my hoops to get your medicine.
Right.
And it's like, oh, okay.
It's hard to tell what she means unless you're there for the context, but you found,
right,
that, you found that, what, for 6 years you were a member of WHAM, what made you finally leave?
I finally left, but I mean, the pressure was on to give till it hurts, and then you get more. So I thought, okay, I'm poor, I'll give as much as my time. And I was told, point blank, they didn't want me to give my time, they wanted me to give my money. I got a bank loan for them. A few days later, I got my renter's rebate check back, and I gave them $1,300 in 1 week. And people who wouldn't even speak to me, wouldn't even look my way unless they absolutely had to, oh, can I give you a hug? Oh, and I just went like, yeah, right. Okay, whatever. Sure, I'll go along. I'll play, right? And it just goes on and on. I got hit by a car, and I got a $15,000 settlement, and Valerie Corral wanted it. And I have had conversation after conversation with her about, don't talk about my money. I went down there. You want proof? One night I went down there, and she'll say I'm lying, because she already said nobody's going to believe me over her anyway. So I walked in the door, and this man's ranting and raving, because we had been called over to the West Side to give, like, interviews. How much money can you give? I just gave her an SSI printout. Here's my bills. Here's my rent. And this is all I can afford to give. That's why I give as much time. That's when I was told the money was more important than my time. Anyway, this man's ranting and raving. I'm like, what's going on? He says, that bitch talking about Mother Teresa is asking me about my mother's money. Can my mother possibly give me money to give to her?
Now, wait a minute. By Mother Teresa, you mean Valerie Corral?
Valerie Corral. That's okay. Another insult to a sainted woman such as Mother Teresa for her to do
so
that.
So let me understand. You walked into a meeting where a man was expressing some strong objections to something Valerie wanted?
Yes, and it was money. More money out of him.
Mm-hmm. Are people penalized if they don't give money in the group?
Kind of, yeah.
Or
all I could ever get out of her was $3,000. And I asked her for an increase one time. And I got an increase, all right, but not a full increase, just a little bit of an increase. And then I found out that I got 6.75 grams, and I should have gotten 7 grams. So I asked her, I said, what's this? She goes, oh, we don't give that. I said, then why did I get it? And she says, it's like, oh, you didn't. I'm imagining things. It's like, so I went home, and I dug that little baggie out of the trash, and it's got Angie's writing on it, the very person who bagged my pot, her signature on it, her handwriting, 6.75 grams, maybe 45 grams. Anyway, I couldn't even get a whole increase like other people.
So you're saying that this was a smaller amount than people would normally get?
Right. Why? Because I wasn't given enough money. I was so pressured to give money. So when she called and wanted another 15 grand, because she knows I'm on SSI, I can only have $2,000 at my possession at one time. I guess she figured I'm going to give her $13,000. Dream on, girlfriend. I got bills up the yin and the yang, and they're all paid off, and my life is back to the way it was. The lady she did set me up with, she did do that for me. But at the same time, I told her, if you don't help me out, my friend's going to land on your doorstep and tell you how full of yourself you are.
What's the decision-making process in WHAM? Is it sort of a top-down? Is it a consensus?
It's a pyramid system, and everything lands at the top with her, and she shoots everything down.
So she makes the decisions?
Total decision.
What about, I mean, are there a group of people, like does Mike have some involvement,
oh,
other
yeah,
people at the
board,
top?
There's supervisors, you know, like the board of supervisors. She has a board of supervisors, too, right?
But have you appealed these decisions to the board?
You can't. You have her, some of her own board members want to take her before the board. Not happening. It all lands at the top, the pyramid system, and they shoot everything down.
How many people are on the board?
I have no idea. I know some of the board members, but I don't know exactly how many there are. And I've heard people say, well, I want to get on the board and I want to change things. I want to have these people get off the board saying you can't change nothing because Mike and Val won't let it happen. We held meetings at Loudon Nelson Center there for a while. It was like, come to the Loudon Nelson Center meetings if you want to express, you know, grievances or whatever. Then we'll go down to the drop-in center and have the regular meeting. So I was attending these meetings because I had grievances. Nobody heard a word I said. Nothing was changed. And then another, the man who, about the violence and the broken knee and all that.
Hang on a second. Now, what were the grievances you expressed at that meeting?
Oh, there again, it was about money and, you know,
now, what were the grievances,
and
what
stuff
were the,
like this.
What were the grievances about violence?
Well, that wasn't me. That didn't happen to me. That happened to someone else.
Right, but I mean, there have been some allegations of violence within the group. One, is that to you a credible problem or something that is simply disputes between individuals that doesn't really concern you? Or is it a continuing function of the structure? There was a similar problem in Camp Paradise. I don't know if you know about Camp Paradise. It was the homeless run encampment at Larry Templeton, who was taking a courageous stand to open essentially a campground to people who had no place to go,
right,
was also
that.
Being violent to some of the individuals who were there and
right.
And dominating them and so forth.
Right.
That can happen in a top-down structure.
Right.
I mean, I've been accused of being domineering at the Huff meetings, for heaven's sake. Can you imagine? You know, but I mean,
right.
what is your sense? I mean, do people show up at meetings with black and blue marks on their face, or is this something that just
like that.
What I'm saying
is too smart for that.
I mean, you didn't. I mean, for 6 years, you obviously didn't feel that there was a real problem in violence that required you dissociating yourself from the group, right?
Okay, this violence I understand has taken place at the garden, and that's one place I don't go. And
take place at the what? I'm sorry, take place at the what?
The garden.
Okay.
Where the pot's grown, the Wham garden. I guess this is where it's taking place, and I don't go up there. And the reason I don't go up there is because the first week of Wham, one of the members called me aside for whatever reason and told me how people go up there and steal the medicine. Right, and I was instructed at one point that if you're going to go to the garden, you know, when you go to the garden, you ought to go to the garden. I said, I don't want to. I don't like gardening. I have hay fever. I don't need to be around pollen and all this and just be sick all the time, right?
And that is how people are actually do exchanges. They go up and garden, and then
they get.
Now, does that work effectively as an exchange in your view, or?
I mean, what do you mean?
Well, if a person does a certain amount of work, then they get the medication that they need.
Okay, listen, let me finish. I was told go up there with the waffle pattern shoes, you know, with the waffles in the bottoms. You can walk around and pick up the bud and take it out of your shoes later. Well, I said, no, I'm not doing that. I didn't want to go up there. So I was almost forced, you know, to just pressure on me. Okay, I'll go to the little shed and trim. Why? I've only got one hand. I have multiple sclerosis. I'm blind in my right eye, and I have paralysis on the total left side of my body. You have to hold a bud with one hand and trim it with the other. So I was literally forced into doing a job I couldn't do. Went up there and did it. And when you were done, they would they just throw out all this pot on the table, and they say, okay, this is this. This pile is this. The other pile is that. Take your pick. Take a bud. So, yeah, you're right. But these guys, I understand, like pocketing it, walking around, getting it in their shoes. And there was a guy outed from the garden because he couldn't walk around. He was in a wheelchair. He was stuffing it in his pockets and got caught.
And so this was the reason you think that there was there some violence involved in this situation?
Yes, I understand. Now, this didn't happen to me, but the person did happen to come to me and said, I was talking to them about mold. There's been all kinds of rumors going around. I've told people, you're crazy, you're insane. Oh, my God, get off the phone. Don't even, you know, I don't want to hear this. So I'm with you. I know. All I know is what I've seen and the pressure I was put under to the point I just dropped out after giving them a bank loan.
You're saying that by rumors about mold, you mean some concern about the quality of the product?
Right. And I did some investigating with growers and botanists and horticulturists who were degrees that I know, and they all assured me, as soon as you light fire to it, the mold dissipates. It's burnt off. It's gone. It won't hurt you. So, okay. Let's squash that one.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's been people trying to gather evidence on them and build a case against them for years.
And you're not sympathetic to that?
To what?
To building a case against them?
I wish somebody would and get rid of them.
So you are hostile to them?
I want somebody to claim eminent domain on that land.
You don't believe that it's relevant if there's some mold involved with the marijuana, if there is, because you've been credibly informed that that's not important? Or?
Right, and how much moldy pot have I smoked in my life?
So that wouldn't be a reason why you would be critical of the corral.
No, but right. A lot of other people are, for whatever reason. But, oh, God, mold and this and that and the other thing. Well, just like my trimming
right.
job, everybody jumped me.
Well, at the current time, Wham is really the... It's not really a distributory for, you know, for people in the city or even out of the city. It's obviously a cooperative or a collective which, you know, services a relatively small number of people who are, you know, who presumably exchange services and I guess money from what you're saying,
right.
for a medical product. And many of them are seriously ill.
Right.
And you are apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And have you been able to obtain your medication elsewhere? Or?
I just have gone private, totally private. I'll announce it to the world. Send the cops there if you want. I've just gone private. Like, I've never had problems in my life. If I start having problems now, oh well.
So,
it's not like I haven't been in jail before, you know what I mean? Not like I haven't been on probation before. So go ahead, pounce on me, do what you want. I'm not afraid.
Well, June, listen, I appreciate your calling in. Is there something you want to conclude with? I'm running up against noon when I'm expecting another interview to start.
Oh, just like I was saying about my settlement, my $15,000 settlement. She wanted it, or as much as she could get her hands on. And when she called my house, and there was a witness here, too, the screaming match me and her got into. And why does anybody have to get in a screaming match when somebody calls herself Mother Teresa? You know what I mean? But I just told her, you know what? I've told you before. You don't talk about my money. How rude, how vulgar are you? I hate this. I'll give what I can when I can.
It's
I'm poor. I'm blind. I'm crippled. And I just told her, that's it, you don't get a dime. And she didn't, and my life is back to the way it should be.
How long ago was that?
That was, it'll be 2 years ago this September 5th.
So she hasn't attempted to retaliate against you?
I dropped out of WHAM for
right.
that reason.
Okay.
And now my life's back the way it was. I can go back to Asia, which I'm going to do in June, and get the treatments I need for my MS. No insurance, no money. I go abroad, and that's why I'm not in a wheelchair yet.
What improvements would you suggest, if you were on the board of directors of WHAM, what kind of improvements would you suggest?
Oh, checks and balances. This man who was attacked in the garden said that night in Loudon Nelson, we need a system of checks and balances. Watch the money. Where's the money going?
So there was a man who was assaulted
right.
by some WHAM members because
by Mike Corral, I understand.
Because he thought he was stealing medical marijuana.
No, because they got in an argument over mold.
Oh,
and he was going, I want to tell everybody, blah, 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 and I guess that's when it happened.
Do you know the name of the victim?
Yeah, but I don't feel at liberty to tell you.
Okay, okay.
Because he's scared out of his mind.
Right. How long ago did this happen?
Oh, let's see, my accident was 2 years ago, so his was like 3, maybe 4 years now.
And was this issue resolved between them, or is he still a member of WHAM?
No, I don't believe he is.
But he hasn't suffered any further assaults or problems with Mike?
No, but he refused to. I said, you should have gone and reported it. But I didn't want to slander WHAM.
Well, I understand there was a report made about an assault. I don't know if this is the assault that the report was made on.
Who was it by? Do you have the name?
I don't. I've spoken to WHAM members in the past, some of whom have been critical of WHAM and fearful, actually, of WHAM. But they seem
people
to be doing okay.
People have feared their lives. People have quit, gone into hiding,
right.
everything.
But again, my question to you is, what kind of procedures would you recommend to the corrals and to the board of directors to rectify these problems?
Where's the money, number one? Like, where'd my 10 grand go? I've given approximately 10 grand over the years.
So
where's it gone?
So you'd like an open, kind of transparent accounting system?
They have a pay and no sheet. If you can get your hands on the pay and no sheet, and if I get the bank to give me my records, which I can, let's compare them. Let's see. Or did the pay and no sheets, like somebody said, I bet they're having a shredding party right now.
So are the accounts open to members who want to see what's going on, or is there
I don't know about that.
Have you ever requested to look at the accounts?
Oh, yeah. I told her one day, one of our screaming matches, where's the money? She imploded. Just ask her where the money is, and you're going to see someone
Implode. Well, other than in a screaming match, have you ever made, a written request to WHAM to so you can see your accounts and see what became of
your
money?
Yeah, she screamed at me, you want to see the books? You come to the what books is she going to show me? The one she's made up or the real one?
Well,
that happens in all business. Come on.
Well, she did offer to show you the books, though.
Yeah, knowing I can't do math, knowing I don't know anything about that. I'm kitchen help. You know what I mean? Muffin maker. I'm the milk lady. You know what I mean?
Well, perhaps, again, looking at the question of how to improve an organization, assuming that it has these problems that you've mentioned,
you need somebody watching them, watching the money. You need somebody watching the garden, making sure people like George Hadimoto isn't having, like, big old barbecues and parties, and he's out there with the money I've given WHAM to for the garden and what have you, supplies, doing barbecues. To the point we can't get anybody to volunteer because George got to go to George's party. Can't go volunteer in the kitchen.
So you would look. You would want someone. You of course normally in financial situations there's a board of directors meeting that's open
right.
That's open to the members. Are the board of directors meetings of WHAM regularly announced? Can people come to them?
Oh no.
Can members?
You only get called before the board when she's going to out you, like she did me one time.
So you would suggest perhaps that there be open board of directors meetings that
something to that effect
where
yes.
people can make inquiries and
right.
where there's a treasurer's report things
right.
like that.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Well, as I said before, Valerie Corral has unusually responded 3 times in the last week to phone calls that we've been playing phone tag, in other words. And
right. Oh, you'll play phone tag forever.
Well, it's been suggested to me that that may be a possibility, but I'm giving her the opportunity to be on the air if she'd like to. She's welcome to come into the studio. She's listening. She's welcome to call in. And what I'm going to do now, June, I'll give you a chance to get kind of wrap it up, and then we'll open the lines up to other people to talk. My guest, Robert Letterman, who is going to be on at noon, I haven't mentioned this before, but he's a member of a group called Artist, which is a group protecting the civil rights of artists in New York City, mm-hmm. and quite an eloquent speaker and writer, famous for his pictures of former mayor, New York City Mayor Giuliani as Hitler, mm-hmm. because of his behavior toward the homeless and toward street performers.
He
may or may not be reachable today. And hopefully he will be, but my producer hasn't been able to reach him yet. Mm-hmm. So why don't you sum up, and we'll open up the lines and see what others have to say.
Okay.
Have you pretty much said your piece?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I go take my antibiotic.
Why don't you go do that?
Okay.
All righty. So thanks, June. Thanks for putting out your thoughts.
Okay, and that's it.
And sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And you're tuned to Free Radio 101.1. www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse. The community discussion about Wham. It's a serious critic of Wham has just called in, former Wham member June. As I said, any Wham members who wish to respond, and I wouldn't assume that Wham members are intimidated after all. I don't know. I don't know what I'd assume. But people have the option to call in. However, I believe I just got a note from my producer that Robert Letterman is going to be on shortly, so if you got a call, you better call now, because this is your opportunity to call in. I'm going to read a little something to kind of give you a background on this Letterman interview. Giuliani degree sparks uproar in Middlebury. The selection of former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani to receive an honorary degree and deliver the commencement address May 22nd at Middlebury College has sparked a campus controversy that led to the resignation of the editor of the student newspaper. The controversy has spilled beyond the campus thanks to the school newspapers printing a retouched photo which appeared at first glance to be Hitler giving the Nazis salute, but on closer inspection had Giuliani's face. Yeah. Unfavorable reaction came from sources around the country. College President Ron Leibowitz sent a campus-wide message denouncing the action, and the student editor of The Campus, the name of the newspaper, resigned. Enough inquiries about Giuliani came in from alumni and parents that Eric Davis, secretary of the college and the administration's official link with the honorary degree committee, wrote a letter explaining how Giuliani was selected. And each spring, a call for nominations for the following year's commencement speaker is sent out to members of the junior class, the faculty, and the staff. Nominations are reviewed by a committee that consists of 4 students, 3 members of the board of trustees, 3 members of the faculty. The committee, which is chaired by one of the trustee members, forwards a slate of nominees, who then invites one of the persons on the list to be the commencement speaker. Giuliani's name was submitted as nominee last spring. There's a reason for recognizing him with an honorary degree and inviting him to be commencement speaker. Speaking to The Campus, when Giuliani's selection was announced in March, Davis said one reason his commencement speech will be especially meaningful to students in the class of 2005 is that the September 11th attacks took place on what was the second day of classes for the current seniors. Not all students are in agreement. The newspaper, The Campus, has been and continues to be the focus of debate. The students may have suggested Giuliani because they will never forget the terrorist attacks, but the college's official announcement also praised Giuliani's record as mayor of New York City between 1993 and 1997. When Giuliani entered the job, this is a quote from this administration, more than a million New Yorkers were on welfare, and violent crime and crack cocaine had devastated entire neighborhoods. During Giuliani's 8 years as mayor, New York City's crime rate fell by 57%, and the FBI designated New York as America's safest large city. Whole neighborhoods were redeveloped, and 691,000 people were moved off welfare. But Middlebury senior Albert Ben-Gor of Maryland said in the next issue of the paper he could not forget how Giuliani's much-praised cleanup of crime and homelessness actually took place. It was due to the overall drop. Let me take the caller first, and I'll read you some more of this article. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Robert, it's Anita. I'll turn the radio off when you're ready to take my call.
You're on the air right now, actually.
Hey, Robert, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. We have to make it quick because this call is coming in from New York City shortly.
Well,
so
that's exactly why I'm calling in. You said this is your best opportunity.
Go
and
for it.
So I said, let me take the opportunity.
Do it.
First of all, June, that was just an amazing story, and that was a very interesting story. I really wish Valerie would come on and with me, and we could kind of talk about things like this. And get them resolved, because I know she doesn't want to have this kind of reputation. But what I, the only two comments I want to make, as I always make notes when I listen to your show, is number one, mold is extremely important if it's in your cannabis. If you have AIDS, you don't want that mold, because it will live in your lung and you'll die. So I guess if you don't have any respiratory problems, maybe you don't care if there's mold. Secondly, George Hanamoto also doesn't associate with WHAM anymore. I believe he left with his wife, Jean, who was doing their marijuana art several months ago. And I don't know on what terms or conditions that was.
Right. I know. I think she left, June left about 2 years ago, too.
Right, so. But now George is gone. He was like the gardener. He tended the garden primarily mm-hmm. for Mike, and things kind of ran under him. And mm-hmm. I think he was more socially just up there. He was... how can I explain how George was? You know, George appreciated the work you did when you were up there. He understood you needed to take a break. It was hot. And I think they... I don't know.
So perhaps things have gotten worse.
I don't know. I shouldn't speak about things I don't know.
Sure. You know, Anita, I want to talk to you about this. My problem is the other caller has to get in. It's a long-distance call. So
I'm going to definitely let you take it.
I want you to call back. Can you call back?
If I'm still inside, it's a beautiful day. I'll be listening in the car. And if I can call back, I will.
I appreciate that.
Okay, bye.
Thanks, Anita. And phone lines open, hopefully, for Robert Letterman. Again, the student newspaper, the editor who resigned, had written that criticizing Giuliani's 1993-97 crime drop, saying it was due to the overall drop in the use of crack cocaine during the 90s and not Giuliani's policies. He added that some of the decline was based on a campaign of brutality and intimidation against the poor and non-white residents of the city. Giuliani's neighborhood redevelopment was gentrification and represents efforts of the rich to displace the poor. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello?
Yes, hi, this is Robert Letterman in New York.
Hey, Robert, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
You're a little bit soft. Talk up if you can.
Okay, how's the...
That's better. I've been reading a story, actually, the... I think it was the story that you sent me about how first I've read the story about the firing of the campus editor, the newspaper, the campus up in the Vermont University.
Right.
And the claim that Giuliani had, you know, caused a reduction in crime, 93 through 97, and the response of one of the critics, a guy named Gore, that wasn't the case because... the crack cocaine rate was dropping in the 90s, and there was a policy of neighborhood redevelopment by Giuliani that involved gentrification, efforts of the rich to displace the poor, and Giuliani, far from being a moral authority, an important symbol for his country, is an authoritarian, a racist, and a shill for a president that many, if not most students here find morally reprehensible. And then, of course, as a consequence, they did a Robert Letterman-like picture of Giuliani as our old Führer Chancellor Hitler. Now, here you are. What's happening there, Robert?
Well, in a sense, my fondest dreams have come true in that other people are picking up on the Giuliani-Hitler analogy. Giuliani has been compared to Hitler more than any other figure in the history of the United States, and possibly more than any other figure in the entire world other than Hitler himself. And where there's smoke, there's fire. Many of the people, of course, that have made this analogy have done it just based on his personality. But when people really do the research on Giuliani, on his career, on the different associations that he has, and most particularly on where he got his ideas, it emerges that there really is an extreme right-wing and, in many instances, actual Giuliani-Nazi connection. What this college newspaper editor and the person that wrote the article have done is basically revive something that was a controversy in New York for the entire 8 years that Giuliani was mayor.
Is this an issue, Robert? By the way, let me introduce you first. You're Robert. You are... director, member?
I'm the president of Artists Response to Illegal State Tactics, also known as ARTIST. It's a First Amendment advocacy group for New York City street artists. and myself and the group have won numerous federal lawsuits protecting the right of free speech on public property.
Most recently?
Most recently, we overturned a permit requirement in New York City parks for artists. Previous to that, I won a lawsuit about protesting in front of the U.S. Capitol. Previous to that, we won a lawsuit about a license requirement for artists on the streets. And those lawsuits are being copied referenced all over the United States in municipalities, small and large.
But you lost the fight to stop the advertising on kiosks?
Well, I wouldn't say we lost it. I never tried to stop what's called the Street Furniture Initiative. I was exposing certain aspects of it, and we were particularly concerned about laws that would come along with it. We're not anti-advertising, even if the advertising is being done by the far right. They have the same First Amendment rights that I or anybody else has. So I'm not hostile to them being able to advertise. The issue with the street furniture ad kiosks is that the city wanted to give it an exclusive contract for free speech to one right-wing advertising company, Clear Channel Communications. That contract has been held up by a lawsuit that was filed by newsstand operators in New York City, and the outcome of that is still pending. So the issue of whether the street furniture will even be allowed to be put in is still hanging undecided.
Giuliani was mayor from 93 to 97?
He was mayor from January 94 until December 31st, 2001.
Are things better now under the new Führer, the new mayor?
Well, leaving aside the very big question of are things better, which so many levels you could answer that on.
For street performance.
The new mayor, Mike Bloomberg, not only continued but expanded on many of the anti-free speech policies of Giuliani. He's been having bicyclists arrested in the parks, bicyclists that ride together to make a political statement about the environment.
Critical mass riders?
Yeah, right. And he's been demanding a permit from them, which they didn't have, and literally mass arrests of bicyclists, something that even Giuliani never contemplated anything as ridiculous as that. They're also now trying to create a license for street artists in contempt of all the lawsuits that we want, which is
what's the nature
of mind-boggling. Even Giuliani, after he lost the lawsuits, finally backed off on street artists.
No, that's okay. Can you kind of again clarify the victory that you won and that now the new mayor, and again his name is
Mike Bloomberg.
Bloomberg.
As in the guy, the giant billionaire media conglomerate, Bloomberg News, Bloomberg Incorporated, one of the richest people in America. He bought the mayoralty. It's a job that pays less than $200,000 a year. He spent $150 million of his own money to become elected mayor of New York. He's up for re-election this November. He's expected to spend as much as $250 million to get reelected. Talk about having an agenda. It's certainly not public service the way we see it at any rate. It's basically a furthering of the privatization of public space agenda that Giuliani spent 8 years on.
What's the condition of homeless people in New York City now compared with, let's say, 5 years ago under Giuliani?
What Giuliani began was an effort to eliminate homeless people. That's continued under Bloomberg. Whether you want to look at it as gentrification, which is almost a beneficent way to look at it, we look at it as privatization of public space, and homeless people throughout that process have been seen as completely unwanted elements in the public space landscape. So there's always been this tremendous hostility for the past decade to homeless people in New York. Bloomberg has a different style than Giuliani. Giuliani basically just made an all-out war on the homeless, very publicly having them arrested. With Bloomberg, it's a more subtle campaign to get rid of them. But really the fact is that under Bloomberg, access to public property is not simply being denied to homeless people now. It's being denied basically to anyone that is not a major corporation.
In an article talking about the Vermont newspaper editor's resignation after the printing a picture of Giuliani with a Hitler mustache looking like Hitler, there's a claim that the concern that Giuliani was anti-homeless is not justified because Middlebury Jr. Because a Democrat from a New York suburb, Andrew Carnabucci, suggested that Giuliani's homeless policy implemented suggestions of a 1990 report by Democrat Andrew Cuomo, who was at that point working for a homeless advocacy group, and said Carnabucci, or I'm not sure if you pronounce it that way, New York City now places its homeless in clean, safe shelters where they may receive job training and can work toward their GEDs. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it's first of all, untrue. Second of all, anybody that quotes statistics from the Giuliani mayoral eight-year epic in New York City has to do so with more than a grain of salt. The Giuliani, when he was the third highest United States Justice Department official under Reagan, was in charge of statistics for the Justice Department and for the Reagan administration. And during those years, he became a specialist in falsifying statistics to make politicians look good. When he became mayor, one of the underlying controversies that dogged him for the entire 8 years he was mayor is that basically he falsified all the statistics that became the basis eventually for his reputation. So when Giuliani claimed, for example, that he kept reducing the crime statistics, I'm in my car, you just heard my alarm go off, what he basically was doing was falsifying the statistics by ordering the police to not record hundreds of thousands of crimes that were taking place in New York City. Likewise with the homeless issue.
Where is this documented?
Well, there are many articles about it in the New York Times and Newsday and other papers. For example, police officials eventually came forward and admitted that they were pressured to alter the crime statistics. One of the ways that Giuliani did this was to change the categories of crime statistics. So, for example, in a city like New York with 8 million people, you have hundreds of thousands of assaults that take place every year. Many of them are, you know, fist fights, arguments between people, that kind of thing that lead to a quick fight. And basically what the Giuliani administration did was recategorize those in such a way that they disappeared from the crime statistics. He also took things like car burglaries and break-ins off of the crime statistics. And in a city like New York, where there are literally like 100,000 cars stolen every year, if you take those statistics off the records, it makes it appear that there's this tremendous drop in crime. If you actually look at the newspapers, the daily newspapers from all the years that all of this tremendous drop in crime is supposed to have taken place, every other article is about crimes that were taking place on a daily basis, murders, rapes. child molestations in the school system, and so on.
Another claim by this author is that as for police brutality, Kanabuchi cited Amnesty International figures showing that in the 10 years prior to the Giuliani administration, police brutality had been steadily rising at 30-40% per year. In 1995, I guess the second year of Giuliani's administration, it rose 16%. In 1996, it rose 0%. What do you think? What happened to police brutality?
Again, you have to understand that when you have a statistic such as police brutality in New York City, that statistic basically comes from two sources. One is the Civilian Complaint Review Board, which is an agency where New Yorkers can go to bring complaints about the police. I, in the early days of our struggle, attempted to make some complaints to that agency. I had extremely well-documented incidents, in some cases on videotape, with the names, the badge numbers of the police, and so on. The response that that agency gave me, in some instances after a year or more of supposedly looking into these incidents, was that they couldn't even find a record of those people being employed by the police department. So in other words, and of course these were officers employed by the police department, they continued to be on duty right where I could find them without even looking for them. My point is that this agency that's set up to handle these complaints is a fraud and basically just does a cover-up. The other source for those police brutality statistics are lawsuits that people bring. And I'm sure your listeners can understand that for every, let's say, 100 or even 1,000 incidents where the police abuse somebody, maybe one or two people actually get it together to bring a lawsuit. So those statistics can hardly be taken as a barometer of whether there's police brutality or not. Now, during the eight years that Giuliani was mayor, The New York State Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, launched an investigation and found that the police department itself illegally stopped, searched, racially profiled hundreds of thousands of African American and Latino males in this city for no reason at all other than their race. If you were to factor in those statistics, then New York would have been the epicenter of police brutality in America, and it would have reached an all-time high. My point is, and this is something that any statistician would admit, is that statistics are made to be manipulated, and they can be used to show
whatever you
completely
want.
Contradictory sides of the same issue, depending how you manipulate them.
How about the situation under Bloomberg? Better, worse, the same with police brutality?
Well, Bloomberg is not a stupid man. He certainly learned from the mistakes of Giuliani and has made a concerted effort to not get into some of the same pitfalls that Giuliani did. I'm sure people remember the Amadou Diallo shooting, an innocent man, unarmed, shot 41 times on his own doorstep. There haven't been any incidents quite like that there. There certainly have been police shootings of unarmed people, but nothing quite as dramatic as that. But as far as civil liberties themselves, and this is why I say Bloomberg is more dangerous than Giuliani, because the insidious elimination of First Amendment rights and other civil liberties has actually increased under Bloomberg, but it's all done in such a way that the average person, unless they're an activist, a public speaker, a First Amendment vendor, or a street artist, may not actually notice that these things are happening.
What positive signs do you see, if you see any, on the New York scene around these civil liberties issues? Are there any positive things we should look at, or should we realistically say things are getting worse and that's where it's going?
Well, I mean, it's not like I'm adverse to reporting good news, but I wish I had some to report. In the same way that the Patriot Act and the Bush administration have been an unprecedented setback to civil liberties in the United States as a whole. What's happened in New York in the past 10 years has been a steady decline in freedom of every kind. And at the same time, it's been a steady increase in the rights of corporations and the privatization of public space. And the same way that the Bush administration wants to turn over national parks to oil companies, Bloomberg wants to turn over the public streets of New York and its parks to advertising companies. Bloomberg actually put advertising in the public schools, if you can imagine such a thing. Soft drink and candy ads in the public school for a very large fee of tens of millions of dollars. So, to Bloomberg, the city is basically one billboard. And again, I want to stress that not that we're against advertising. The problem with this advertising is that it comes with an exclusive contract, giving these ad companies basically exclusive First Amendment rights while taking those same First Amendment rights away from the public. That's the aspect of this that the group artists and myself are so much against.
Robert, we're talking with Robert Letterman of Artists, and give us what Artists is again, Robert.
I'm sorry, say it again?
Run by the acronym, what Artists stands for.
Artists Response to Illegal State Tactics.
In the studio with me, I have a local man who's been prosecuted big time repeatedly for California law, which makes it illegal to, quote, interfere with a business and then refuse to leave the business. He's a guy who he looks kind of ratty. He's got a long beard. He advises poor and homeless people of their rights and young people of their rights. And do you have a similar code situation in New York City where businesses are getting, you know, more predatory on public spaces with respect to the poor?
Well, certainly with respect to the poor, most of New York is divided up into 42 business, so-called business improvement districts, which are basically sort of like, one way that I could give you an analogy would be the city-states Italy, a few centuries ago. Every district has its own self-appointed government. They basically ignore the public and a small group of very wealthy business people basically make the rules for what's allowed to take place within their business improvement district. And I'm not talking about within the private property of their businesses. All of this is about the public property of the sidewalks and streets. So these business improvement districts are basically hostile to any individual's rights, including to the rights of small business people within their districts. So it's not hard to understand how hostile to the rights of a homeless person that the same business improvement districts are. They have their own private police forces, and the main things these police forces do is harass homeless people and poor people and vendors.
But yet, at the same time, some people have paid some attention to the information you've put out. They've seen your artwork. You've been arrested how many times for your, shall we say, artistically creative, but super critical portraits of Giuliani?
I was arrested 41 times.
And you've been convicted?
Zero.
And when's the last time you were arrested?
The last time I was arrested was the end of 1999.
Well, what's going on here? What, have you given up being arrested? Come on, man.
No. The city made Mayor Giuliani himself made a do not arrest Robert Letterman policy at a certain point, where I had the most First Amendment rights of anyone in the city. I could literally, and I did this, put my artwork right on his car while he was in it, and the police wouldn't even try to stop me.
This was a picture of Giuliani as Hitler, and the police didn't stop you.
Right. Well, it just got to a point where his own aides started to pressure him that, you know, he was fighting a losing battle to intimidate.
Well, maybe you need to turn out Robert Letterman masks.
all I can say is that my personal experience, and you know, everybody's experience is different, everybody's karma is different. My experience is that the louder and more confrontational I got, the more rights I got. And the more lawsuits I filed and won, the more rights I got. So people were always telling me, oh, why don't you be more, you know, why don't you try to work with these people and work with the business improvement districts and so on. Believe me, I did. But when I saw that their position was, we want to eliminate you, I took my own hardline position. And I've been a very prominent critic of, obviously, Mayor Giuliani and the bids. And for me, and certainly for the street artists in my group, that has been, at least so far, a successful strategy.
We have, we're kind of nearing the end of the time I've got for this. I'd like to talk to you for another half hour because I'm sure there's a lot more we could learn. Maybe I can get back to you at another point. I have, however, in the studio with me our very own political prisoner. Here's a man who has been arrested recently on $50,000 bail for conspiracy to buy a cup of coffee. They didn't call it that. They called it trespass with intent to interfere with the business and disturbing the peace. It's Jerry Henry. He wants to say hello to you. And what do you want to say, Jerry? Go for it.
Well, I just want to say hi. I've equated this all to Hitler here. And I find myself on trial because I've been trying to acknowledge ignorant nigger haters as ignorant nigger haters.
What he means by that is that he feels he is being treated like a person on the back of the bus. And when he uses the word nigger to refer to himself, he gets arrested for it.
And I just want to say hi.
How you doing?
It's unbelievable. This all happens to me out in the little village I live in, and it's social cleansing. It's all the businesses. I find mine coming through the Chamber of Commerce and the sheriff's substation they moved in right in our little village. And I tell people Hitler's alive and well, and he's living here in Santa Cruz, but I know the program started with the one you're talking about.
We may have to get you to come out here, Robert, and do some local artwork.
Oh, it'd be great. They're going to try me June 6th, and they've got me on 11 charges. They've had me on 50 charges, and it's I do a political satire comic strip kind of live in public. And
they don't want him hanging around in the semi-public spaces in front of a shopping center where there's a coffee shop where some people like him and some people don't, but they've decided to start using public authorities to go after him in a way that there should be some civil approach instead of the criminal approach. But let me just sort of cut it off there.
Yeah, it's a pleasure meeting you.
Yeah. Robert, any final words yourself on things we should be looking at here in California if we want to keep advised as to what's going on?
Well, people need to understand about this Hitler analogy that Hitler today is basically famous for the Holocaust, and I'm Jewish, so certainly people have a good reason to be sensitized about the Holocaust. But if you really look at the history of Hitler, it didn't start with the Holocaust. When Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, 1933, the very first thing he did, literally the first thing, was to pass a law called the Law for the Protection of the People. It's exactly like the Patriot Act. Limited civil liberties, it limited free speech, it made detainments without trial routine, which was not the case in Germany at the time. And after he passed that law, he began going after artists and other people that we would call First Amendment speakers here. So when you see the government and government officials attacking an activist, an artist, somebody that's trying to speak, people need to understand that when someone like the gentleman you have there with you or me or any of these other people have their rights curtailed, that this is a threat to every single person's most essential freedom. Freedom of speech is the origin of real freedom, because as long as you have freedom to criticize government policy, the government's ability to completely enslave you is not total. Once the freedom to even criticize, to educate, to give out information is taken away, there is no possibility of freedom. And that's why the Founding Fathers made the first part of the Bill of Rights freedom of speech. They made it the First Amendment for a very good reason, and that's why the First Amendment has always been the foremost target of elected officials and other interests that are looking to enslave the American people. And unfortunately, that effort is reaching a very advanced stage. So people need to wake up and truly embrace their First Amendment rights, exercise them, and make a no-compromise commitment on freedom of speech. No permit, no license, no limitations on free speech at all. Last thing I'll say. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. N-O means no. And that's what we should say to all these efforts to take away our freedom.
Hear, hear. Robert, Jerry Henry has one last comment to make to you.
Yeah, I'm just a disabled person that just, you know, and that's another group of people that Hitler came after. He called them eaters. And I think that's what they label all the homeless. And it's really been a pleasure to hear, because it's right where my heart is.
Did you catch that, Robert?
The case.
Hey, Robert, we're talking with Robert Letterman. If you want to check out what Robert's been up to and what he's written lately, how can we do that, Robert?
You can send me an email, and I'll hook you up to our website. My email address is A-R-T-I-S-T, as in artist, P-R-E-S, as in Prez, at Comcast, comcast.net.
That's Artist Trez, one word?
Yes.
A-R-T-I-S-T-T-R-E-S at comcast.net.
That's it.
And thanks, Robert. Again, you're very eloquent, and I appreciate your being on the show and giving us some concrete specifics from New York that it's hard to find any other place.
My pleasure. Thanks for the chance, Robert.
Sure. Bye-bye. And that was Robert Letterman. He is co-founder of Artists Response to something, state terrorism, I believe. Got to check his website. If you want to check his website yourself, just send him an email, and he'll send you his stuff, artisttrez, A-R-T-I-S-T-T-R-E-S, at comcast.net. You're tuned to Free Radio. This is 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. Call-in lines are open. That means you, Anita, or anybody else who's out there. In the studio with us, we have Jerry Henry and Jonah. Who knows what Jerry's going to talk about? I know, Jerry, last week you faced the Maragonda, or the Maragunda, as some would call him, a district attorney, also mayor of Scotts Valley, prosecuting you on, is it now 11 charges? I thought it was only 10 charges of intentional interference with a business and refusing to leave and failure to disturbing the peace. I've asked you the question. Here comes a phone call. You want to hold off on the answer? You heard the question. Yeah. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Jerry, Robert, and Jonah.
Hey, Robert, it's Andrea. How you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah, it's nice to hear all the talk, as you know, of the medical marijuana. I want to say thank you to Anita from MedX for helping me a week and a half ago. And I'm still struggling, and still struggling with the poverty issue, and if anybody out there has any, like, bottom-of-the-bag leaf that they could, like, gladly donate, I'd sure appreciate it, because I'm dealing with some really stressful times, and I need all the help I can get. So I just wanted to put that out there, and I wanted to say thank you, and God bless everybody on today's Sunday.
Hey, panhandling for pot, eh?
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, it's come to that time in my life where I got some cardboard, and I've got to make a couple of signs, you know, that say disabled, need help, and I've got to figure out somewhere where I can go and sit, and hopefully people will feel bad for me and maybe give me a little money to help me out.
Instead, I hate doing it.
God only knows.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, instead of these individual efforts, though, I mean, obviously you have to do your own individual efforts. I remember a year ago, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, Huff, civil rights group I work with, talked about a Huff and Puff project, which is essentially a project with the aim of publicizing the fact that the dispensaries in town have all been closed down by the city's own laws. And most recently, this is dramatically shown by the Pacific Coast Cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And also that the price of marijuana, even if there were dispensaries open, is incredibly high. And not to mention the general drug war, which is absurd in itself, and to get some idea what the city is doing around the drug war, why isn't it taking action to stop at least its contribution to the drug
mm-hmm.
war? So, I mean, I'm always up for that. If we get more volunteers at Huff who want to do it, if we've got people who want to supply marijuana, and I've been approached by at least one person who does.
Yeah.
And somebody wants to do some record keeping and so that we are a legitimate care providers, giving to people with legitimate medical marijuana cards so we don't have to worry about defending ourselves against Bob Lee, our DA prosecutor, who tomorrow is taking Roger Minch
into
a sentencing hearing at 8 o'clock. I want to remind people, Department 4, tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
Roger Minch, he's being sentenced up to 7 years in jail for selling medical marijuana to people with medical marijuana cards. Yeah,
I know. I saw that whole half-an-hour show on Club Cruise with him and his girlfriend. And I'm going to set my alarm, and even if I have to drag myself, you know, down there, I really want to get down there. Hopefully there'll be a handicap spot available since there's only 7 of them.
Andrea,
but I got to tell you, Robert, this is a really frightening time in my life. You know, it's very frightening to think to have to go and sit out on a walker so pathetically just be vulnerable.
Well, I'm gonna leave it there because I want to get some more callers in.
Yeah, I'll talk to you later, Robert.
All righty.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. And I did ask a question of my studio guest here, walk-in guest, actually, Jerry Henry. Jerry, you went to a summary dismissal hearing. I guess your attorney, Christine Judd, is that her name? I think that's her name.
Robert, I just stopped by. I just happened to be listening to your radio show and just felt really connected to that call-in speaker.
So you got no comments on the case at the moment?
No.
Yeah, okay. I know Huff was interested in doing some...
I thank you for being there. Have you played that tape my attorney made?
Tape your attorney made?
Yeah, when you interviewed my attorney after...
Oh, I haven't played that yet. No, that maybe on Thursday we'll try that. I've got...
Yeah.
I can never get all this stuff done.
I
did do some tape on last week of this summary judgment hearing. I'm just telling people briefly that, and you're looking over some of the prosecution's arguments. 11 counts against Jerry Henry were systematically refuted in a presentation by Christine Judd. I think I have her name right. Last name is Judd, anyway. Who Jerry has been forced to hire. And, you know, it's, it has to come all the way down from San Francisco to defend this case. She estimated at least, I believe, $50,000 costs from the costing the taxpayers in this particular attempt to exclude Jerry from the Rancho Del Mar shopping center, where he's essentially charged with conspiracy to buy a cup of coffee, being around in the outside areas in front of the Santa Cruz, well, it's the Aptos Coffee Roasting Company, which is Colleen Crosby's Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company, same company, as well as a second coffee shop, the Pacific Coffee Roasting Company, which is at the Aptos Center, somewhat to the north of Rancho Del Mar. And Huff has taken a position, the homeless civil rights group I'm with, that this is a discriminatory action which has to do with the way Jerry looks, the fact that he's exerting his First Amendment rights, the fact that he's counseled people about their right to, essentially it's an attempt to clear away public spaces for the prejudicial preferences of business owners, which really impacts poor people particularly. They're on the cutting edge of all this, and although Huff hasn't done much about it other than issue a flyer, we are hoping to present that flyer in front of the coffee roasting company and give you, the public, an opportunity to weigh in on this issue. It, in the past, when businesses have engaged in prejudicial behavior like this, I have encouraged people to boycott the business. In this situation, and who knows, maybe it's because I'm soft on Colleen Crosby, because I like her personally, she hasn't responded to any of my phone calls on this. I mean, I've talked to her when I see her. She's not running around overseas doing something else, you know, free trade coffee and all that, and that's nice. But I'm concerned, again, about not, civil rights over in, Jakarta. I'm interested in civil rights in, downtown at Cathcart and Pacific, and that's where the person has the most influence, however much, PR they may be throwing into these international or national issues. Rotkin may be whooping it up at the UN, but what are his police doing, up at UCSC, and what are what's his planning department doing at the Pacific Coast Cooperative, closing it down? It's here that it counts. So if you want to keep an eye out for this table, we're probably going to be tabling in front of the Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company as soon as I get a free minute, now that I've got a car back. Hey, the bumper sticker car is back, folks, for those of you who know what it looks like. The windows have been smashed out, but I don't care. It's summertime. So I'm going to be around more, and hopefully I'll be able to encourage you to sign a brief little statement that says to Colleen, I support a non-discriminatory policy at the Coffee Roasting Company and urge the dropping of all charges against Jerry Henry, because all she has to do is, essentially put out the word, and she hasn't controlled the DA's office, but a lot of the testimony would be coming from her employees, and she could make it clear that, she regards his behavior as fine and that they're misinterpreting something as interfering when it's not. Sitting in front of a place smoking when you're not in a no-smoking area, for instance, as much as I don't like smoking, by the way, personally, is not interfering. Nor is saying, why can't this nigger come in? What, you going to treat me like a nigger? Why can't this nigger come in? That, objectionable as the word nigger may be to a number of people, and properly so, it also has a second meaning, which some people actually have earned, even people with white skin. Got to say that. And Jerry Henry may be one of those people. So if you want to actually get more information about this, you can also come to a Huff meeting. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It meets every Wednesday, no longer at Baker Square, because Baker Square does not exist. Instead, we meet in the basement of the county building. That's at 701 Ocean Street in the so-called American Cafe at the unreasonable, absurd time of 8 o'clock in the morning until we can figure out a better time to meet. I'm usually there sitting alone, twiddling my thumbs and reading the newspaper. So come on and join me. And actually, people do begin to drift in later. But we're working on a number of issues, including the Santa Cruz sleeping ban lawsuit. The mayor of San Diego has resigned under a shadow, and there's a big lawsuit in San Diego by homeless people against the police department's practice of arresting people under 647J, which is their sleeping ban, the state law. And it looks like that's rolling forward to a hearing, to fighting a summary dismissal, just as John Maurer successfully fought a summary dismissal case in federal court, a week ago, you heard Paul Sanford talking about that, attorney Paul Sanford talking about the John Maurer case, where in our own community, a homeless person was arrested for wearing a Fuck the Pigs sign, referring to our police department's harassment activity around him, a little teeny sign on his hat. And the city attorney essentially was lying about the issue in court, trying to avoid getting the issue to court. It got to court. The federal judge has actually come down with a decision that this case has to go to trial. It will not be dismissed just because John Barisoni doesn't want it there. And that's going to happen in the next few months, although what probably the city attorney will weasel out with a changed law. But that will give us a chance to look at the downtown ordinances. Anyway, Huff meets on Wednesdays. Come on to that meeting. We're going to be talking about the sleeping ban lawsuit there, the one that we are trying to put together to file. And it's a long process. I originally mentioned this way back in November, and we have been trudging along trying to get, we've been kind of back and forth. We're going to do a facial challenge, we're going to do an as-applied challenge, federal court, state court, back and forth. But we have been making some progress and getting some people on board. And if you're interested, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and you can learn some more about it. And again, tomorrow it's Roger Mensch at 8 o'clock in the morning in Department 4. It's actually in front of the county building. And then at 8:30 in Department 4 for sentencing. And as I mentioned, I'm going to give a letter to Bob Lee, the DEA, saying, what are the stats on the drug war? Mr. Nice Guy Bob Lee, you know, not so nice, actually. And then at 12:15, I don't know if I'm going to be up there, but you might want to check out the situation with Pat True up at UCSC and the attempt to get some straight answers from Chancellor Denton and her lackeys up there, see what they can tell us. Boy, I had a lot more things and a lot more tape, but we're rolling into the last 8 minutes of the show. Actually, looked at the paper and saw Jim Losey. You remember Jim is a Santa Clara County medical marijuana distributor, a care provider. And there's an article in Saturday's paper, Saturday's Mercury News, second section, talking about how the pot club he established, he is apparently closing down very quickly after establishing it. If you want more information, go to www.area420.com. He said, we're pushing the issue. We're tired of waiting for someone to open a dispensary. He agreed to stop distributing marijuana until he meets with the city's police chief and planners early next week to work out the details of his newly opened and small operation on Stevens Creek Boulevard. Losey intended to use the 125-square-foot office to register patients and verify that they qualify for medicinal marijuana, which he distributes as a caregiver to about 15 to 20 patients a month. Then he learned that Santa Clara, as many other cities have done, were considering a moratorium on pot clubs. So as an activist who runs a medicinal marijuana advocacy website, and again, www.area420.com, he decided to test the limits. Police Chief Stephen Lodge confirmed that he spoke to Losey. I continue reading the story. It's not in his best interest or that of his clients to be involved in the possession or distribution of marijuana until his status is verified. So all you folks out there are feeling pain, just kind of hold up on the pain until we verify your status. I mean, in Santa Cruz, it's only taken 5 years and we have no club, so keep waiting. Things are going to be okay one of these days. Lodge added that Losey must have the proper permits and a license before opening any kind of business. And as for your free speech on campus, get the proper permits before you speak. And remember that. It's permits first, speech afterward. That's not to say the city is going to approve that type of business. California voters approved in 2015 in 1996. While Santa Clara has no moratorium on pot clubs, Lodge said the city is considering it. The state was charged with coming up with guidelines when the proposition passed, and it still hasn't, which is not true, of course. They passed AB 420 and has come up with guidelines. So I don't know what Chief Lodge is talking about. Friday, however, Christine Flora, 40, of San Jose, got her 3.5 grams of marijuana in Santa Clara. She was one of three patients that afternoon who received marijuana from Losey. It's fabulous. This is a great resource center for the patients, said Flora, who said she suffers from recurrent major depression and tension headaches. Justin Merrick, 22, of Santa Clara, usually gets his marijuana from a mobile dispensary that delivers it to him. We definitely need a dispensary here so people don't have to take long trips to Santa Cruz. I don't know what you can get in Santa Cruz. I guess there's MaryMed in the county, but not in the city. San Francisco, a lot of people can't do that, said Merrick. He said he suffers from chronic and major depression, anxiety disorder, and recurring migraines. He received 2 grams from Losey on Friday. Losey said he hopes to be part of the city's planning and shaping any regulations. I intend to work very much within the law. He said, personally, I don't want to own a big dispensary. That's never been my goal. So, good for you, Jim, opening a dispensary and then having to close it again. Sounds like, I would say a dispensary on the sidewalk with a table would be a cheaper way to go and wouldn't require a permit. I mean, if you've got adequate care providers. So for all you medical marijuana activists out there who actually want to get active and stop jawing away on free radio about this issue and watching people disappear into the boonies like Matt Hilliard and Peter Koch, who suspect they're vanishing. I haven't heard anything from them in the last few days. And want to see the prosecutions by that big liberal Bob Lee stop for marijuana generally, particularly medical marijuana. It's time to get out there in public and just do it. Just like the students at UCSC just did it. And they won. Even when the police arrived, they still won. You can win if you have the courage and the numbers. And you're not going to get the numbers unless you show the courage. That's where it's at. So think about that, and I'll rant and rave on. Of course, I'm just ranting on my radio show. But you can give a call to 423-HUFF if you want to be involved in any of these projects. You can give a call to Mayor Mike Rotkin. He's not really much of a Fuhrer. He's more of a Ducker and a Dodger. At 420-5023 and ask him, where is that medical marijuana there, Uncle Mike? Here's a phone call. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello?
Hey, Robert, it's Andrea.
Hey, Andrea, go for it.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I just call in right now. I was busy with our guests. They just checked out, and we've got more coming today. On May Day, I'm going to be working right here like this on the big Laborers' Day. But I'm going to get over to the Poet and the Patriot and tip a brew and see a movie on the Wobblies at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, so. I heard about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be good. Hope you can come over.
I may stop in, although I'm going to probably miss the beginning of it.
Uh-huh. We got so many film festivals going on now, the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, and then the Real Works, which is about labor movies. Mm-hmm. Labor movies and the San Francisco or the Santa Cruz Film Festival next weekend.
Have you listened to any of the discussion from critical of Valerie Correll of Wham by June and others?
You know, I didn't because we were catering to our guests. I didn't get to hear that, but I heard that there was like people that called in and were critical of the Wham organization.
Oh yeah, and I guess Anita called in. She offered to, of course, be present for as a sort of a mediating force if Valerie wants to come
on
here.
Right, that's how I found out. Anita called me and said that she had called in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that, frankly, I'm still glad that Wham is doing its thing. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time waiting for Wham. I mean, we can do what we need to do ourselves, just like you are.
Well, you know, I don't want to dwell on negative things. Also, I want to move this movement. We're already in such a bad shape here, as far as the whole movement is concerned, that we don't need to tear each other down. And I'd rather move more positively toward trying to get a dispensary here or a co-op or something in Santa Cruz, so that all these patients can get their medicine.
Well, I think, as I said before, I think it's going to require direct action. I think the time for licking Rotkin's ass on the sly is kind of long gone. I'm not saying you do that, but I'm saying that trying to do that doesn't seem to be very effective. And although he continues to tell us, maybe you have some new information for us, that he is studying the issue. He studies that, man. We need to get out there and do something, like Jim Losey did, apparently, over in, he opened up a dispensary himself,
mm-hmm.
and then closed it down. But he said he was doing it as a way of drawing attention to it, and he did. It got in the paper. Uh-huh. So I think, we don't need to spend, I don't know how many thousands of dollars like the Pacific Coast Cooperative. We just need to set up a damn table in front of City Hall or a table in front of the Pacific Coast Cooperative and a little sign that says, register here for medical marijuana. This is where we're going to do it. And I've proposed this before, and I know people have looked at me and said, "Oh no, no."
We don't have a dispensary here, and fairly soon, what other choice are we going to have,
right.
Robert? I'm really a little discouraged with our city council also, and the fact that they're not moving on this, and it's falling on deaf ears.
Yeah.
I spoke on Tuesday at the Oral Communications.
And I played your speech.
And, oh, well, it wasn't very well prepared.
It was
I
good.
Just smoked a joint before, and I was, really kind of not. But anyway, what I said was true, is that we really need a dispensary in downtown Santa Cruz, and this is not going to be the scene that Mike Rock can speaks about. It's not going to become a drug dealer's mecca. If anything, what it's going to do, it's going to take the drug dealers that are selling the marijuana on the streets now off the streets. Like this gentleman that spoke right before me is from the Beach Flats, and he was complaining about drug dealers outside of his door and approaching him on the street, and trying to sell him drugs. Nobody would. I couldn't imagine looking at the guy why any drug dealer would ever want to approach try to sell them some drugs. He never said which drugs, but let's face it, 90% of the pot 90% of the drugs that are sold out there is probably pot. And these are people that are, that need a little bit of extra money. They're on the streets. They're doing this just to, raise a little bit. I don't think they're big-time drug dealers or even that they're dangerous in any way. Yes, I don't want them on the street, but I think what it does, that plays into the fear mentality, and that the way to solve this problem is by putting more police and, you know, on the streets to arrest these people, to prosecute little small-time drug dealers, to wreck, you know, their family's life and their life, put them in jail, give them jail time.
And
what
there's also a sort of a sinister secondary agenda we saw up in Berkeley and in Santa Cruz, where the real objective is to get rid of scenes on the avenue, like the scene in front of Borders or a scene in front of New Leaf Market, mm-hmm. where they just don't want street people and youth and kids hanging out. They're too grubby. They're too rude on occasion. They're too, often homeless. And it's an attempt mm-hmm. to gentrify the area. And what mm-hmm. they do is they use the drug laws illegitimately to mm-hmm. do this.
You're probably right there on the dot there, Robert, because the downtown merchants, this is bad for business to see these grubby kids out there, and the fact that they are rude and panhandling and probably dealing a little bit of pot or whatever, you know, out there as well. It's the gentrification idea. And I'm sorry, but Santa Cruz is a very diverse place. We want it to be this way. And so I know a lot of the people that come to our inn. See, you can't take it easy. One of our guests is still leaving here. And he's an attorney. He defends pot cases, defendants up in San Francisco. And he comes down here on a regular basis. But, you know, it's just that medical marijuana is something that's outside of that. It's not, these are people who are sick and dying. And they're not homeless people. They're people who have doctor's recommendations that are regularly seen by a doctor, and they have cancer and AIDS and MS and a whole host of other illnesses. These are not people who are street people. And it's a, you know, they're going to go into these little the dispensary, they're going to buy their cannabis, and then they're going to get back on the bus, and then they're going to leave the neighborhood.
Andre, anything about Proposition Z? I know you're trying to get together stuff at the 420 celebration for, you know, to kind of repeat the victory of Oakland here in Santa Cruz. Any update on that?
Well, we're looking at that. We have our little focus group going, and we're having meetings. This is more a tax and regulate measure that we're considering for the 2006 November ballot, and basically what that would do would be pretty much the same thing that Oakland did, and that would be to make police enforcement marijuana the lowest possible police enforcement priority. That's the first thing. Another thing that it would do, it would make it incumbent on our city council to lobby the state legislature to legalize cannabis in the state of California and tax and regulate it. You know, most of these counties and cities, are having this incredible budget, crisis now. If we just taxed marijuana and we brought it in off the streets and sold it at regular stores, that are regulated, you know, they have to check ID, and drug dealers don't check IDs, and it was sold to responsible, upstanding citizens of that happen to be pot smokers. Why should pot smokers be discriminated against? Even medical marijuana patients can't get their medicine right now, and they have the legal right to it. You can imagine how many pot smokers that are out there like this that have to sneak around and face criminal prosecution for having the kind of thing that they want to do with their body. They don't want to drink alcohol. They don't want to smoke cigarettes. They want to just smoke pot. And these are people who are good, productive people. I'm one of them. And I shouldn't be discriminated against because I use marijuana recreationally.
Yeah, I hear you. Unfortunately, you got to get to your 1 o'clock movie.
Yeah.
And we got a 1 o'clock show here
All
that's
right.
about to play. If you know.
All right.
Late.
So we'll talk more about this legalized tax and regulate cannabis.
We'll do it. Maybe I'll
All
see
right.
you at the movie.
Okay. Good.
Right. Bye bye.
Thank you, Robert. Bye bye.
All right. And that's it for Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Alexis, thank you for reminding me that you actually do have a show, and I better get my butt out of here. Hey, check on the show if you want to catch some things you've missed. www.huffsantacruz.org is where we're archived. Be back on Thursday at 6 o'clock for more, and maybe I'll hear you then.